Blog Talk Radio.
That music means it's time for another thrilling edition of Movie Geeks United.
That is like the most enthusiastic you've been in a long time. But no,
I try to give like a Joe Friday spin on my opening tonight.
Well, that's good for you, man. That's good. No, it is. We do have an awesome show for everyone tonight. So thanks for joining us.
Yeah, we're going to talk about a really interesting new project that stars Ellen Burstyn, and we'll be talking to her in connection to it. And I'll set that up a little bit later before we're ready to start that interview. But we're also speaking to the director of that film. And then we'll get into Avatar a little bit, just a little bit. And then we'll go to Golden Globe predictions.
Okay.
Which is always fun. I like these roundtables. And every year at the Oscar predictions, we always bring in special panelists and to help us out with it for their perspective fields. We'll have an editor talk about editing, that kind of stuff. That's always fun.
No, it is. It's always a good time. And Jason and I in that room.
Yes, that's good. The news that came out, a couple of, maybe less than 2 hours ago. I wanted to mention this, that Brittany Murphy, the actress Brittany Murphy, has died at 32 years of age of a massive heart attack. Brittany Murphy, you know, from movies like 8 Mile and Just Married and...
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's terrible, but
no, it's very sad.
The last movie I saw of her that I was really taken by her in was a movie called The Dead Girl.
Yeah, no, that's right.
Yeah.
That's...
So, I mean, details aren't really known, but it is a heart attack. She was found this morning by her mother.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's a loss because you know only 32, and you know there's a lot there. I mean, I thought she was really good in Spawn and 8 Mile. And obviously, like you said, The Dead Girl and The Groomsman, one of Ed Burns' movies. So she was all in Sin City, obviously. She had a good part in that. And she's been around for a while, Sidewalks in New York. I mean, I can go on and on here. But, I mean, she's only 32, and we don't know what the exact cause of that heart attack was. But, you know, you read something like that, and it just catches you off guard.
Yeah.
I don't care who you are, and you know, it's just a mess.
And you see her, I mean, just from an outsider's perspective, you see her, and she always seemed very bubbly and full of life.
She had a Gina Carano vibe about her. I mean,
she reminded me of Drew Barrymore a lot in that respect. That kind
mm-hmm.
of life.
Well, wasn't she
life
in that
force.
Drew Barrymore movie, Riding in the Car with Boys?
Yeah.
Which was she like stole every scene that she was in that movie. So I mean.
Yeah, it's just too young.
Mm-hmm. Very young.
So getting on another topic. Snow, dude. You're there in Maryland,
mm-hmm.
and I just called you dude, and you're snowed in, right?
Well, we're snowed in. We can get out now, but we were snowed in, but it was fun. I mean, you know, we haven't seen this much snow in a long time, so it was very nice. Yeah. I'm not complaining.
It's funny because the blizzard does have an effect on box office gross, obviously. People
I knew you were
going
to bring this up. I knew this was
a whole a whole section of a country can't get to the theater,
mm-hmm.
necessarily. So they look at this kind of stuff, I'm sure. You remember that episode of Entourage when they open up Aquaman and there's
right,
a big powder
right.
outage. Power outage, yeah. They worry about this kind of stuff, so I'm sure people were biting their nails at the Avatar camp because of it. But still did well. It didn't make the biggest December opening of all time. It came a few million shy of I Am Legend, which is the record holder for the month
mm-hmm.
of December. But
yeah, it's still third. It's still it still came in third, but I think it would. They were expecting, I think originally from what I read Friday, if the weather didn't, they were thinking $85 million was
yeah.
the number I heard that was being thrown around.
They
have no competition though.
In 3 days, Avatar has made $232 million worldwide. 3 days.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Man.
That's
a good
a
business
when
it works. Yeah, yeah, it absolutely is. We welcome everyone to the chat room. Yes, we're accepting phone calls tonight.
Yes, give us a call.
You should feel free to give us a call if you want to share your thoughts on Avatar, or if you want to talk to us about your own Golden Globe predictions, which we'll be doing about 45 minutes from now after our interviews. The interviews are pre-recorded, so we cannot accept phone calls for either Ms. Burstyn or the director of the film, Ms. Markell. But they
right.
have fascinating things to say. Let's get to the interviews. This is an interesting project. My love of theater, I love Tennessee Williams. I always have. My dream play was Glass Menagerie. I think it's the greatest piece of theater ever written. So I was really excited when I heard about this project. Tennessee Williams wrote a screenplay that I think Elia Kazan was slated to direct, and it kind of fell by the wayside somehow.
Right.
He wrote it before he died, directly for the screen, and it has gone unproduced up until now. And this stage actress and director, Jodi Markell, she found the play in a book. And said, "Man, I want the screenplay in a book." And said, "Man, I want to make this into a movie." And so she has, with a fantastic cast attached to it. It's called "The Loss of a Teardrop Diamond," and it stars Bryce Dallas Howard, Will Patton, and Margaret Ellen Burstyn, who you'll hear from in just a little bit. It's got a great cast, top to bottom. It's a beautiful, beautiful film, and it's just a real treat to hear that great Southern Tennessee Williams language and those.
Mm-hmm.
Just exceptional female characters. They're strong but wounded women that Tennessee Williams wrote so well. Let's hear first from the director and see how this project got off the ground. Ms. Jodi Markell, here she is. From reading about you, your exposure to Tennessee Williams, that started back in high school, didn't it?
Yes. Do you want me to talk about it?
No, please, go ahead.
I wasn't sure if you were asking another question. When I was 15, I was cast as Laura Wingfield in The Glass Menagerie in high school, and I was just immediately smitten. And then by the time I was 17, I had read almost everything I could find written by Tennessee Williams. And I just felt an affinity for his characters that are sensitive, looking for something true in a more conventional world, a more traditional, harsh world.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he speaks to a lot of young people who have artistic interests and tendencies, or anyone who feels a little bit of an outsider like Williams did his whole life.
Yeah. I actually asked Ms. Burstyn about this earlier, but I love Tennessee Williams as well. So, but a common thread throughout most of his plays are his strong female characters.
Yes.
And I'm wondering how you define his unique stamp on crafting a female character.
He was fascinated, it's in his work, it seems to me, with women who were too sensitive, too beautiful, too sensual, too wild at heart, too intellectual, too witty, just too. He was interested in those ladies who did not feel that they were in place in a conventional world. And I think that at first, when we meet those women, like Blanche DuBois or Maggie the Cat, that they might seem a bit too wild for us, or too abrasive, or just unfamiliar. But by the time we reach the climax of the play, we're feeling for them, and we understand them. And
mm-hmm.
I think that's because he's a poet, and he writes with the language of the heart. And he said once, "I put poetry in my plays. I put it in my screenplays. I put it in my short stories. I'm really just a poet." And I think that sort of has a feminine sensibility sometimes. I think he was also interested in women who project on men, looking for something true in a man, just desperate to connect. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a universal longing.
Yeah. And this project is unique in that this is a previously unproduced original screenplay by Tennessee Williams. Mm-hmm. And when you found this I imagine you were given a book. I think I read that you mm-hmm. were given a book that had this mm-hmm. included in it. Was your first instinct to make it your feature directorial debut?
Well, I was only in my early 20s at the time, and I was just not savvy to the business in any way. I just thought to myself, why hasn't this been made? I love Fisher Willow, and I want to see her come alive. And so I carried it in my heart for years, and I showed it finally when I met Brad Michael Gilbert, our producer. I showed it to him, and I mean, he just understood what I was what I was seeing in this, and he saw it too, and he took it. He went straight to the estate and tried to get the rights. But at that time, the executor of the estate was it was just very hard to secure the rights for any of his material except for doing it on Broadway, mm-hmm. and. It was a very infamous situation. A lot of people have written about that time period with his estate. So Brad kept revisiting it, and I kept we kept talking about it through the years, and he was able to finally secure the rights. In the meantime, Brad had produced a short film that I directed, also based in the South, also from a great classic Southern writer. And we had a wonderful experience, and he really entrusted me to direct the film.
Yeah. Well, once you received the blessing of the estate to take this on, was it a difficult project to get off the ground? Because these kinds of projects you don't see much of in recent times.
Well, it did take a certain sensibility for people to be interested in. However, Brad's approach was to go straight to the actors, and that's what we did. Mm-hmm. And as soon as we were able to secure such wonderful actors, that really helped us with the rest of. And Brad had a young company, and he had financing, so he was able to make it happen with being the one calling the shots, as opposed to turning it over to a studio or.
Right, right. And tell me about the actors, because so many phenomenal actors in this film and just beautiful performances. Bryce Dallas Howard is phenomenal as Fisher Willow in this film. And
yes.
I'm wondering what qualities you saw in her that made you visualize her in this role.
When I first saw her, it was in M. Night Shyamalan's The Village. And I had never seen her before. I didn't know who she was. And I was just stunned. I was, who is this actress who can stand in her shoes and be present and be authentic and genuine and yet so strong and earthy, and she's got so much soul.
Mm-hmm.
I hadn't seen that very often in younger actors, and I just had to know who she was. And at that moment, found out a little bit more about her, and I also remembered seeing her name in the theater as a New Yorker. I've, also as an actor, I see a lot of off-Broadway shows, but I never gotten to see her, but she paid her dues. She went to NYU, studied theater, and then she did several shows off-Broadway, and I knew we needed someone who had a classical theater background and was able to work with language. Sometimes Williams is almost like Shakespeare. It has its
mm-hmm.
own rhythm and musicality, and if you don't get that, it's not going to fly. So I knew we needed actors who had interest and experience in theater. So same with Ellen Burstyn, who's the head of the Actors Studio, and she's one of the greatest actresses of our time.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, sorry.
No. It's interesting that you said you wanted your actors to have stage experience.
Mm-hmm.
Tennessee Williams transposing his material to a film, both in terms of you as a director and crafting these performances with your actors, is it a difficult balance to get right tonally for a film?
Oh, yes, definitely. And I felt like what I wanted to make sure was happening was that it was always rooted in a genuine, really in the genuine needs of each character and not in the trappings and mannerisms and sort of overblown, overbaked, exaggerated kind of trappings that get put on a lot of Williams' work.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to get rid of, just pare it all down to just, you know, what the, letting the actors connect with each other and simplify it. I don't like it when I see Williams done in a sort of curiosity piece way where, you know, let's just see how weird we can make it or, you know, that kind of thing. I just wanted to get to the heart of his original voice. That being said, this was the only screenplay he wrote directly to be filmed. So it isn't like a play in many ways. There's, you know, a lot of locations, there's movement with the characters and space that he could not do in a play, and the storyline is completely more expansive in a lot of ways, and the time frame, etc. But I thought that the style of the acting was more in line with classic cinema than with theater. We wanted to harken back to the days of the films that were made around the time he was writing it, like East of Eden, Kazan's East of Eden, in the scope. We used CinemaScope, and we were trying to create a larger-than-life canvas for the actors. And I think that in all these ways, it's different from doing a theater piece.
Yeah, but you come from the stage, really a terrific resume on the stage, and I'm wondering what the greatest learning curve was for you when it came to directing your first feature with this film, and how did you surprise yourself in that role?
I think, of course, working with the camera is the greatest learning curve because, you know, I have such respect for cinematographers and what knowledge they bring to the set. I knew every second I was going to be learning something new about lenses and crossing the line, which is still a challenge for me. What was the second part of your question? Because I started thinking about
how did you surprise yourself as a director?
Oh, I did. You know, the stamina surprised me because this is a little bit spiritual of a statement, but I find that when you're directing, you're using so many different parts of your brain at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be so many things to so many people and yet still stick to your vision, and you have to hear what everyone has to say and then make a choice. You're taking care of someone who's upset that got their feelings hurt in the makeup trailer, and then this, you know, a catering truck is late, and you're dealing with loss of light, and you're, you know, somebody's headphone isn't working properly, and there's just so many things to handle and to take care of. It. What happens is I felt really at peace in the middle of all of it. It was like the center of the cyclone. You know, it was like a you find this kind of balance in the hurricane. You know, you found the center of peace where you can make your decisions, and that surprised me because I and then of course there were times when it was hard. And challenging. But I think that the stamina that it takes surprised me, and the fact that I was able to stand up to that also surprised me.
You did a gorgeous job. I really love this movie.
Thank you.
I'm curious, this last stage where you're finally getting it out to an audience, you've lived with it and nurtured it for so long, and when you show it to the festival audiences or any other audiences that you've screened the film for, does anything about it surprise you, kind of seeing it for the first time through their experience?
Yes, I mean, it's true. It's almost like having a child where you raise it up and then you have to let it go, and it's going to go out into the world and it's going to have experiences with people and relationships that you'll never know about.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of got that sense when I was at the Chicago Film Festival. I usually just kind of peek in at the beginning and come back for the Q&A. But there I watched the whole film because the audience was just, they got just every little subtle detail in that film. It was a 400 seat house, and it was just amazing to me that, you know, William's so strong that he just can speak to people all over the country. And I had a man come up to me at one of the festival screenings and say, "I think this is the most loving Tennessee Williams movie ever made."
Mm-hmm.
And that meant so much to me, because I really feel that, you know, there is a part of William's work that's not known by most people because they think of it a stereotyped way from a lot of the overbaked productions that I've done in the past. And I really feel like there is so much love in his work, and I hope that people can get a chance to experience that. And I really hope the audiences can get to the theater to see it.
That's so true, and it's certainly what I find in the best productions of Williams and in your film, because like you said, there's a tendency in a lot of productions to just play the Southern heroine, and there's such strong women, but what I find in your film is an enormous vulnerability that this lead character has as well.
And I think that, you know, Williams is such a vulnerable soul, and I think that that is one of the timeless things that speaks to everyone when people can connect. And I had a young girl come up to me and say, I am Fisher Willow, and I'm that's why I made the film. I wanted to bring it to a new generation and have them relate. And I had another woman say to me, she picked out one line. She goes, "I think," and she was sort of surprised. Like it felt like she had maybe never seen any Tennessee Williams. She goes, "I think," and she picked out this one line. She goes, "I think that's the best line I've ever heard in any movie I have ever seen in my entire life." And because the language is refreshing for us, because we're not used to that.
It's beautiful, and Miss Burstyn's kind of monologue to Fisher. It's just, I was just riveted. It was like I was, all time stopped, and I was just in that moment. So I do love your film very much, and I wish you the very best of luck with it.
Well, thank you so much. It means a great deal to me. Thank you.
The movie is called The Loss of a Teardrop Diamond. It opens up in limited release in theaters on December 30th. I believe it's also available on demand, if I'm not mistaken. On demand.
I'll have to go check that out. Awesome.
It's a terrific movie. And now it's time to hear from Ellen Burstyn. Ellen Burstyn, just a dynamite actress.
Definitely.
We all know her from The Exorcist is probably her most infamous role.
I like that, infamous. I like that. It's a good choice of words. Good.
Yeah, but do you think about how demanding that movie was and that role?
Oh, no, you're absolutely right.
Physically, emotionally, I mean, and she's the star of the film.
Mm-hmm.
She gives it a lot of resonance. Also, movies like Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore with Scorsese,
mm-hmm.
which is a real change of pace for Scorsese early on in his career, making a female-centered film.
That's true.
When he was coming up with Mean Streets and all those tough guy movies. Requiem for a Dream, you know, probably most recently, that really garnered her a lot of acclaim. Mm-hmm. But really on and on, her resume is just staggering. And she is terrific in Loss of a Teardrop Diamond. We talk a lot about particulars in her performance and how she reads Tennessee Williams and translates it into film. Here's Ellen Burstyn. I'm a huge fan of Tennessee Williams, too, obviously. I was wondering, have you had experience performing Tennessee Williams material in the past?
Only at the Actors Studio. You know, I worked on scenes.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't do a whole production. Tennessee sent me a play that he wrote about Zelda and asked me to do it, Zelda Fitzgerald. And
yeah.
I love that character, and I love Tennessee's writing, but I just didn't happen to like that play. So I didn't do it, not realizing it was my last chance until now to do a Tennessee Williams production. So,
yeah.
So this is really my first full Tennessee Williams project I've done.
Well, when I think about Tennessee Williams, obviously he has a number of qualities that make him stand out as one of our great playwrights, but particularly his depiction of female characters.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you define his unique voice when it comes to crafting those characters?
Well, I think he was interested in women. You know, very often writers, the characters they're interested in are the men, and the women are kind of accessories,
mm-hmm.
where Williams was really interested in the women and what was happening to them interiorly, and you know, was interested in exploring that. I think the love that he felt for his sister and the sympathy he felt for her made him more attuned to women than a lot of writers are looking at women from a man's point of view, but Tennessee
yeah.
was really looking at women from their own point of view.
And the female characters, they might be construed as having kind of contradictory elements to them. They're very strong-willed but very vulnerable as well. But you see that in something like The Glass Menagerie, the way he viewed his mother as opposed to his sister. It's very complicated, his
well, I think that was part of his interest, is in the complexity,
mm-hmm.
you know, and the qualities that were not consistent but were present in one moment but not in the next moment. It was the combination of qualities that makes a character interesting. You know, if somebody is just the good wife or the bad mother or the you know, rebellious daughter, that's not so interesting. But when there are all of those things, then we
yeah.
start to get a full spectrum of a human being.
Well, the scenes you have in this film, there's a couple of scenes, but they're so crucial to the piece, and there's so much there. But I'm wondering, is the preparation you do different when you have a few scenes to create a character as opposed to where you have all the time in the world to relay an arc of some sort?
No, not at all. In this particular case, I went to a hospital and observed a woman who had had a stroke and had the physical characteristics that Miss Addie had. And so I would have done that if she was throughout the film or just in the two scenes that I'm in, because it was this concept of a woman who was a world traveler. She wasn't just any woman. She was a woman who traveled the world and wrote about it. So movement was the essence of her existence, now suddenly unable to move. You know, that was the essential problem.
Yeah. And how, in your mind, does your character in this film mirror Bryce's character? What does she have to teach her, do you think?
Well, Bryce is an outsider. I mean, Fisher is an outsider who doesn't fit into the conventional construct, society's idea of the way a person ought to live, especially a young lady. And Miss Addie is someone who didn't fit in either. She was a different kind of person. I'm not sure, but what she wasn't homosexual. I have a feeling she might have been, because she was very independent and unmarried and, you know, traveled the world. And there are certain indications that I got that she might have been a mirror image of Tennessee. And, of course, he was always an outsider, even when he was a famous playwright. And so she took full responsibility for her life, even to the point of wanting to decide when it should end.
Right.
So I think she holds up a model for Fisher of what an independent woman can be that's not going to make the conventional choices.
I would think that the atmosphere on the set had to be particularly special because it's an original, unproduced Tennessee Williams piece, and that feels kind of like callow ground for an actor.
I would say there was a sense of keen dedication. There wasn't any cynicism or any, let me change this line, or I'm not comfortable with this word, you know. It was, the work was held sacredly.
Mm-hmm. And is it difficult to master Tennessee Williams tonally, particularly in a cinematic performance?
Well, I don't know if I did, but if I did, I didn't feel any hardship in that. His language is so beautiful that it supports you, you know. He expresses things so poetically that it's easy to feel what he was getting at, you know.
Yeah. And tell me about, I want to ask about the directors that you've worked with as well. And on this one, you have Jodi, and she comes from the stage. I'm wondering if you could tell me a little bit about her and if you think that stage experience is important for a director on a film assignment.
Well, I think stage experience is important for any theater artist. I think people who are trained for the stage and then can move to film easily, but it's not true the other way. People who are film trained, when they go to the stage, I've seen it too often where, because when you're in a film, you're pretty much only acting when the camera's on you,
mm-hmm.
you know, whereas you're on stage, you're in the scene the whole time. And I've seen actors who come from film and go on stage, and they're only acting when on their lines. And the rest of the time, they're just kind of standing there. They're not being in that environment and living in that environment.
Mm-hmm.
And Jodi having stage experience and acting experience makes her much more skilled in listening and detecting the subtleties of acting and knowing what the process is. So I always love working with directors who've been actors.
Mm-hmm. And the ones that you've chosen to work with, the best, Scorsese and Friedkin and Aronofsky and on and on and on, these seem to be very edgy filmmakers, and I'm wondering what qualities you respond to most from a director.
Well, I love creativity, period. And if a director is creative in any way, whether it's with the camera or the text or the whole overall conception, I get turned on by other people's creativity. So, like
mm-hmm.
being around somebody like Marty or Darren Aronofsky, it's exciting, and it you know, lights a fire under me, or adds flame to my fire. So those are my favorite directors, the ones that are imaginative.
Mm-hmm. And you've been acting for many years, and I'm wondering what acting gives you now, the importance it has in your life and the satisfaction you get from it, and how that's matured or changed throughout your career.
Well, early in my career, I wasn't sure of myself. I wasn't sure that I could come up with what my concept was. And sometimes I did, and on occasion I didn't. And as time has gone by, I've learned more and more ways to make myself be relaxed and have have what I need in a scene available to me,
mm-hmm.
you know. And so it's gotten to be more satisfying because there's less tension and more assurance, and at the same time made me look for new ways, new difficulties to explore. And then, you know, I teach a lot, so I'm also sharing what I know, so I've gotten clearer about it.
You do teach, and you teach at the Actor Studio. And
yeah.
I think you're on the yourself and Mr. Pacino and Keitel.
Yeah, we share the presidency, and right now I'm functioning as artistic director too.
Tell me about the actors coming up now, and how they possibly compare with when you were coming up.
Well, when I was studying with Strasberg, you just did study. You didn't just expect to work only when you were employed.
Mm-hmm.
You studied all the time. You closed in a play and were back at the studio the next day signing up to do a scene. And, I mean, I've even had the experience of doing a play I wasn't successful in and signing up at the studio and bringing it in to Lee to show him what I was doing so I could have some analysis of where I missed. We don't have that as much now. There are some actors who do, thank God, and we have some very exciting new actors at the Actors Studio. But I work often with actors who the only time they act is when they're employed, and therefore they're as Lee Strasberg used to call it, their instrument isn't in tune. They
mm-hmm.
don't really know how to go to the depths, you know. So I, whenever I can, I encourage actors to get in a workshop, even if they've done a television series or they've performed on Broadway. They should be in a workshop when they're in between jobs, so they stretch their talent.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let me just say that this is a beautiful film, and you give a gorgeous performance in it. And
thank you. I'm so glad you liked it.
You're phenomenal in everything. We all feel that way. But thank you so much for giving us your time today.
My pleasure.
Okay, that's Ellen Burstyn. The movie is The Loss of a Teardrop Diamond. It's in limited theatrical release on December 30th, so look out for it. I believe that's a Wednesday, next Wednesday. And it's not available on demand. I misspoke
okay.
earlier.
Okay, I just wanted to add something. We had spoken about the untimely passing of Brittany Murphy. Last week, though, we lost Jennifer Jones and also Alien writer Dan O'Bannon passed
mm-hmm.
away. And I know he had been suffering from an illness on and off for years.
It's interesting. You talk about Scorsese, as we did for a little bit with Ellen Burstyn.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a major influence on Scorsese growing up,
right.
was the Gregory Peck film that he did with Jennifer Jones. What is that movie?
Isn't
Why can't I think
of
it?
Sun? Aren't we thinking
Duel in the Sun,
yeah.
right. Why can't I think of Duel in the Sun? Yeah, so that was a classic film that's inspired many people. And
mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Yeah, it has.
I believe she was 90 years old when she passed.
Mm-hmm.
And we also lost a film critic yesterday, Wood. Ronald Wood, maybe?
Okay.
His name? He really championed the horror films of the 70s, the political overtones of the...
Right. Okay. All
right. We have a phone call, 831 area code. Let's see what we got here. Pick up this line. 831, are you with us?
Yes, hello. My name is Christina.
Hi, Christina. How you doing?
Hey, I'm doing great. I'm calling from Salinas, California, and I just wanted to tell you... you know, thank you for having this actress on. I absolutely love her. I've seen almost every movie she's made, and when I found out reading the description that she was going to be on, I thought I have to call in and just tell her thank you for deciding to go into acting because you really do it justice.
Well, I'm so sorry that this was a pre-recorded show, but I will relay your message to her. It was a pre-recorded interview that we did with
her.
But I can absolutely understand. What were, in particular, were some of the performances that you've been taken by with her?
Well, okay. The Exorcist, of course, okay? But then
right.
the Yeah, Sisterhood, I'm probably saying the name wrong. But that movie was just really, it really touching. and
right.
I could relate to it.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of people could. And, you know, I just wish her lots of success and continued and, you know, just many blessings. She's a wonderful, wonderful actress.
Now, are you an actress?
No, I'm not. I just love reading books and watching movies. And, you know, she picks very good scripts. And,
mm-hmm.
You know, that's key as well. And, you know, I just wanted to just give a shout out and wish her a happy holidays. And thank you for having her on. I know it's pre-recorded, so.
Well, we will definitely relay that message
yeah,
to her. And you're absolutely right. I mean, she continues to pick these very challenging scripts. I mean, she's been in the business for so long, and she's just look at Requiem for a Dream or Barbara Bush in Oliver Stone's W
or on and on.
The Fountain,
yeah.
Yes. Big Love. I wanted to ask about Big Love because that's one of my favorite shows, and she's a
yes.
main part of
we
that.
We watched that. She plays the mother of, the first wife. The first wife,
Triplehorn.
Actually.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean,
yes.
We really appreciate you calling in and listening into the show. We value that a lot, so thank you.
Well, thank you so much for taking my call, and I wish you guys a happy holidays.
You
likewise.
Too.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Nice call. It's good to get a nice call, everyone.
It is always nice to get a good call.
There are nice people out there.
There are.
Gives you faith in the world.
Yes, it does.
Okay. Let's go through before we get into Golden Globes, because Chris will be calling in and possibly Jason will be calling in, depending on what his wife tells him to do.
nice one, baby.
We'll talk a little bit about Avatar when Chris gets on the line. But the SAG nominations were also announced, and those take place January 23rd. And it looks pretty much in line with what I thought. If you look at the...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's, I think, what the Oscars are going to look like. I honestly
mm-hmm.
do believe. As far as the movie portion goes, obviously, yeah, I think that's a much better barometer than the Golden
yeah.
Globes, obviously.
Ensemble, because what makes them unique is they give out an ensemble award.
The Indie Spirit, but they already. What was it this year for the Indie Spirit? It was that they gave.
Are you saying they're not unique? Is that what you're saying? The SAG Awards are not unique.
I'm kind of saying that the Indie Spirit. Yeah, I'm trying to start a war between Indie Spirit and SAG. Yeah, that's my goal, Jamie.
That'd be great. You know, Indie Spirit would win because they have Spirit and they only have SAG. They're too saggy. All right. The Ensemble is an Education, The Hurt Locker, Inglourious Basterds, Nine, and Precious. It's a tough category. I would have to choose Inglourious Basterds because there's so many discoveries in Inglourious Basterds from all at an international level. You know, it's an international cast.
He gave Diane Kruger probably the best role of her career. And I don't know Melanie LaRoche, but she's incredible.
She's
and
a fine.
Christoph Waltz just walked.
Yes.
I watched it again yesterday, and I have to say he owns the supporting actor category.
Yeah,
I watched it again yesterday, and he just gave him all these juicy lines and just the facial expressions he makes throughout the film.
He doesn't play it obviously, and that's what makes it chilling.
Mm-hmm, yeah, I mean, there's just some great. Well, we watched it again yesterday, and there's just some great moments with him towards the end. I'm just like watching him. Like, it's his category to lose, essentially.
Well, he is nominated for a SAG along with Stanley Tucci for Lovely Bones, Christopher Plummer for Last Station, Woody Harrelson for The Messenger, and Matt Damon for Invictus.
In another year, I would go with Woody Harrelson for The Messenger.
Really?
Oh, yes. He's superb. And he's a very good actor. And I've noticed when he took a long break there, but when he's come back, he's really been at the top of his game. But in another year, I would give him the award. Hands down. Now, I have not seen The Last Station. I finally saw a trailer for it the other day, and it does look like Christopher Plummer is having the time of his life as Tolstoy. There's
mm-hmm.
no doubt about that. Now, I might change. When I see The Last Station, I might come back and say differently.
He is a very joyful actor. He what he does.
Yeah, and he's also very good in Parnassus, actually. He's, you know, mm-hmm. he really actually, I think, holds the film together. He and Tom Waits as the devil.
That's
are
great.
Actually really
That's great.
Are very good in that.
Actresses, female actor in a lead role. Sandra Bullock for The Blind Side, so that's another stepping stone for Sandra Bullock getting Oscar nominated for
mm-hmm.
that movie. I didn't mean to sound like I was I was talking badly about that movie. I didn't mean it to sound like that. Helen Mirren for The Last Station, Carey Mulligan for An Education, Gabori Gabby Sidibe for Precious. How do you like that? Do you like the pronunciation there?
I like it. It's very good.
It's probably not right, but Meryl Streep for Julie and Julia. Actors, Jeff, which I think that this is dead on for the Academy, Jeff Bridges, Crazy Heart, George Clooney, Up in the Air, Colin Firth, A Single Man, Morgan Freeman, Invictus, and Jeremy Renner, The Hurt Locker.
And it's a tough category to call.
You'll notice that the one that's not in there is someone that we predicted earlier as a possibility with Daniel Day-Lewis at 9, but I think that movie's critical reception has been
I think it's this year's Evita.
Pretty chilly.
Do you think it's this year's Evita? I mean, the trailer, incredible trailer, and then just, it's flat. It sounds like...
I love Evita. I'm in love with the movie Evita.
But, you know, here's my thing about Evita. I think the real star of Evita is Antonio Banderas. I think
that's... I do, too.
But what I've always, I was talking about with my mom the other day, is that Madonna was born to play Evita, and it just doesn't work for some reason. That's the one part of the film I think doesn't really work.
I think her singing works. You know?
I have the soundtrack. I'll go back and listen to it again.
I think she's in the best voice of her life on that album.
Okay,
She studied like mad. She also studied like mad for Dick Tracy. She knew she had a batch of Sondheim songs.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, Chris.
Hey.
Hi, Chris.
Hey.
God, hey. I came just in the nick of time for all this Evita talk.
I know, really. I mean, you were probably like...
As soon as our inner gay starts coming out, Chris calls in.
Finally, somebody's talking about Evita.
Oh, you're too funny. Okay, so that's the SAG Awards. They also nominate TV. And so we
they also nominate TV.
Right. So let's talk about the Globes in a second, but I want to get everyone's take on Avatar. We have a call here. I don't think it's our... Well, we have a couple of calls. Might one of these be Jason? I'm not sure.
It's the Jason O'Brien Show, part two.
Hang on. 650 area code.
Yo, what's up?
How you doing, man?
Pretty good. I'm just here listening to the show, and I just thought I'd drop in to let you guys know that I have a really big penis. I can suck my own cock.
Great, you and Ron Jeremy. That's awesome.
Oh, and he hung up. Man, I was really wanting to follow up on that.
I wanted to find out about his cock. I think it was John, but that's just me.
No, that wasn't John. John can't do that.
No,
Well, you know, thank you. I guess we invited that with the inner gay comment. 774.
Oh, great.
All right, Coach, let's see what jewel we have here. 774.
Hello?
Hey.
Yes. How are you guys doing?
We're doing good. How are you?
Pretty good. Well, the same thing with the last caller. I also have a very big penis.
That's great. Thank you, Ed. Well, give us a call back later and tell us how it's going. All right.
I feel like his mouth will be full, probably. He won't.
That's right.
I
want to
ask what kind of career he's got with that. Like, if he's making some extra money on the side there, you know?
Now here's someone with not a very big cock. Here is Jason O'Brien. Or Patrick.
You bastard. I should hang up on you now.
Baby, what's up, Jason? How you doing?
I'm good, Jerry. How are you?
I'm good.
Nobody cares about me.
Do we now have
the
Avatar roundtable discussion for at least a couple minutes?
Yeah, well, let's talk about Avatar just a little bit. okay. We've all seen Avatar. I know that for a fact.
Yes.
So let me ask Chris first. The buzz... The anticipation, because I know you and I shared this tremendous anticipation over this film. Every time we get together, we talk about it. Was it worth it? Does it live up to it?
I thought it far exceeded the expectations, personally.
Wow.
Blew them away, in fact. I thought it was a much better movie than... I can't say that. I was about to say I think it's a much better movie than people giving it credit for. The truth is, everyone I know who's not a total movie nerd is absolutely head over heels for the movie. And everyone I know who is a complete movie nerd has these sort of mealy-mouth reservations about it. And they seem to complain about it out of the side of their mouth and then out of the front of their mouth say nothing but great things about it. It's like a lot of movie nerds really want to they really want to shit on this movie for some reason, but they can't
they
find
to a fail. They want him to fail.
Yeah, they can't find a good place to shit on it. So, you know,
I can't find anything wrong with the movie personally.
I can't find anything wrong with the movie either. Actually, I think it might be. In fact, I do think it is the best movie of the year. Certainly the most interesting movie-going experience of the year. And I think it's right in line with everything James Cameron's ever done, possibly his best work, actually.
I'm willing to give you that.
I really do think it's some of the best stuff he's ever done, and stands on par with stuff like The Abyss and The Terminator. You know, I mean, it's in that level for me, and beyond that. I mean, I think it's in the Star Wars level. I think it's in the Wizard of Oz, King Kong level. I think it's that kind of movie.
Mm. I think it's the film George Lucas could no longer make.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would imagine that George Lucas is looking on at Avatar in envy.
I think he's trying to slit his wrist.
I would imagine, and we've heard from other filmmakers, everybody's looking at Avatar. Steven Spielberg, Soderbergh, Kevin Smith. Filmmakers are looking at this, and they're seeing, forget about what he does with the aliens, with the Na'vi. That's fine. We've seen Gollum before, so that's not it. But that's not what's impressive about it. What's impressive is the way he uses the 3D technology.
Yeah. You feel like you're there. You don't feel like it's coming at you. You feel like there are certain scenes that I feel like I'm actually there.
Right. You're actually there, and the world seems completely genuine. And not just the outdoors and the rainforest canopy and things like that. Even the sets, even in an office building, even in a lab, there's so many textures. His use of color, his use of shadow, his use of light, the use of depth of field in this movie is incredible. Like it's sort of mind blowing. There's an amazing shot at the end of the movie where Stephen Lang's character is in his mecha fighter thing, and he's staring forward at about 50 yards of rainforest canopy, and he's also looking in his rear view mirror, which is on screen, and you can see in reverse directly behind him 50 yards. Through the canopy, and you can see in that rearview mirror someone charging him. It's like three different things for you to look at in this, multiple things for you to look at in this one shot. It's absolutely amazing, and the possibilities, not just for an adventure or a sci-fi film, I mean, imagine the possibilities this could have in a thriller or, you know, in a musical, in a period piece. I mean, this kind of use of 3D could be applied in so many different ways. And actually, it's going to be like what Steven Spielberg did with the CGI in Jurassic Park. Like, you can use it in a lot of different ways, but it took a long time for anyone to get as good at it as Spielberg was in Jurassic Park. And
that
I think
the Rosetta
same thing
Stone.
Right. I think the same thing's going to be true with this 3D technology. Mm-hmm. I think it's going to be a while before we actually even see anyone who's able to use this technology as well as James Cameron did.
I agree with you, Chris.
Well, Jason and I had a slightly different take on it.
Well, what was that? Because
yours were the mealy-mouth complaints I was talking about.
It's not mealy-mouth complaints.
Before we get into you and Jason, because you guys already had your own show, like the show of shows that Sid Caesar used to bring us in the 50s and 60s, I have to say this is the first successful film to really just, this is a blanket indictment of U.S. imperialism that I've ever seen since, I really have to say that James Cameron really just showed everyone, you want to make a movie that criticizes U.S. imperialism, you don't want to hit people over the head with it so much, you know, do it directly. There are other ways to do this. He does that. Otherwise, I actually think he also gets great performances out of his actors. And there's great dialogue. It's a great story. Sure, there are elements. I mean, what is it? Giovanni Ribisi is obviously like Paul Reiser in Aliens, or Stephen Lang is like Michael Biehn from The Abyss, and Michelle Rodriguez is like Vasquez from Aliens. He likes to use these same archetypes, you know, from his other films, but guess what? They work, and they work very well in his hands.
And those archetypes weren't original in The Abyss or in The Terminator or in True Lies or in Aliens. I mean, they were already borrowing from other. Right.
He likes to use them, though. Obviously, it's become very apparent. You know, it was like I was talking about with Jamie on the last show. It's like, you know, he hasn't done anything in 12 years, but all this stuff comes crashing back in the first like 10 minutes of the film. All these characters from his previous films, and you're right, Chris, they come from, you know, what is Aliens essentially is Back to Bataan with John Wayne in outer space, essentially. Or and this is obviously, you know, and I think it's selling it short, saying it's Dances with Wolves, a rip-off of Dances with Wolves. It has elements of that. It has elements of Lawrence of Arabia. It has elements of a lot of different things, and he does it very well. He recycles it so well.
Right.
Okay.
Come on, boys. Come on. No, come on, because not all of us were privy to listen to the show last night, so tell us what's going on.
You know, I feel, and I actually made this clear, I feel to criticize this movie I feel like an asshole if I criticize this movie. Because obviously so much love and went into it, so much passion and imagination, stuff that is so sorely missing from cinema now, an original vision, so much is great and jaw-dropping about it, that it makes me, the weaknesses I found in it, made those especially egregious to me.
Mm-hmm. But you can criticize it, dude. It's all right to criticize things. People love you. They're not going to worry. You have an opinion. You have an integrity. It's called integrity. So go for it, dude. Tell us what you didn't like.
I think Cameron's one of our best action directors and one of the greatest visionaries working in film.
Okay.
I think Avatar is a prime example of those
skills.
Right. It also, like Titanic, accentuates his weaknesses as a writer. He's obvious. He's really obvious. And that kind of that tone kind of bothered me. But
he'd be the first to admit that, though.
Yeah, exactly. So it's not a critical.
Mm.
It's not too critical.
Okay. What about Mr. O'Brien, though?
I like the political stuff. I got the political stuff. I was surprised at how overt it was, how overtly environmental it was, and I didn't mind the environmental stuff.
No, not at all.
But there was something, and I told this to Jason last night, and I don't know what it is. It's weird. There was something that really bothered me about seeing people cheer at American troops being killed. And it's not something that I've ever felt before, but that could be the stuff with wars and stuff that's been happening lately. That's outside of the movie.
Wars,
I guess.
You up, Jamie. That's what it is.
It's just my own perception. It's not the movie necessarily.
Maybe I'm a little confused. This is what I meant when I said earlier about mealy-mouth complaints. Like, you say, in one breath, you say, Cameron is obvious. He's always been obvious. And then in the next breath, you complain because the movie is, it's too obvious. Like you say, the whole imperialism, the whole environmental thing. It's not subtle. There's nothing subtle here. I don't see what's wrong with that. I mean,
movie for Americans first and foremost, and it's. I don't think it's as obvious as you think it is. I mean, let me ask you this, Jamie.
I think it's terribly obvious. I think a lot of it is obvious. Stephen Lang's character is as obvious as it gets. It's the worst written character in the piece.
Right.
Thank God we already interviewed him. Okay. Let me say this though. You're talking about this cheering about American troops. Aren't these the same in the same vein? These troops that you're talking, these American troops, are the clone troopers in Revenge of the Sith, and the stormtroopers in Star Wars are essentially the Americans because that's a metaphor for Vietnam. I mean, you have to put that, it is. I mean, I'm sorry if you don't agree with that, but George Lucas, I sold the rights to Apocalypse Now because
well,
of Vietnam movie Star Wars, and the stormtroopers and the clone troopers are American troops. I mean,
if that's an allegory for Vietnam, then it goes without saying that we haven't learned shit from Vietnam.
No, we haven't learned shit from Vietnam,
well,
but that is an allegory. That is George Lucas's allegory for Vietnam. So the thing that you're talking about with Avatar, that, yeah, you're disturbed by the killing of American troops in that sense, that's the same thing with Revenge of the Sith, with the clone troopers and all that. They're American troops.
It's not a criticism of the movie, though.
Okay.
That was something interesting that I found about the way I perceived it. That
oh,
was
okay.
My
no,
own.
Your perception and your perception is right. I mean, it is your perception, so it is correct.
Yeah, it wasn't a criticism of the movie.
No. Okay.
It was just something that surprised me about my reaction to it.
Mm, okay. What about Mr. O'Brien? Does he have anything to say?
Well, yes. What was interesting about Jamie and I talking about this, you know, we said at the start that it's actually kind of complicated to review. It's not one that, you know, because there's interesting things. Like, I'll just kind of summarize it in that, you know, when you're spending $250 million on a film, the story has always got to be key. And to me, it simplified things too much. I mean, yeah, it's obvious in a lot of ways, and what I wanted to see was a key point that I thought, for instance, it would have been more interesting if we could have seen why Earth needed this unobtainium, which really pissed me off of the poor writing that they had to call it unobtainium. I mean, they could have come up with anything that would have been a little more unique. But, I mean, to understand maybe why Earth needed it so bad and create a more complexity about, you know, put us in that situation, make us understand why Earth is suffering so that we can actually feel for, you know, this rape and pillage of the planet that they're doing. Make it a little more complex. Make it, you know, that level of complexity. I just wish the money could be spent, you know, into the story, because that's, I think, what makes this key. But I completely agree that this is an amazing visual experience, and I saw it in IMAX 3D, and it's and I talked at length about how the blue people, I thought, you know, that was one of my big criticisms all year long, but that actually worked for me. The biggest thing that worked for me in the film, I was amazed at the technology of how expressive these characters were,
and incredibly expressive. Surprising.
Oh, I was amazed. I was blown away because I've been a critic of CGI as far as trying to make. You know, dinosaurs are fine, those kinds of things, but, you know, when you try to do a character that's going to have expressive emotions, you know, I've been critical of CGI, so I was very happy to see that the technology had come to such a point that, you know, I could really believe these characters, and all the different expressions on them were amazing. So my criticism is more just from a standpoint of
narrative.
You know, I the story, and then I thought the new agey kind of connection to the thing was so... I mean, it was just they could have made these beings a lot more complex and edgy, you know, something that was a little more depth to these people than just the standard rote by, you know, we're connected to it. It was like Pocahontas or something.
Well,
it is
like Pocahontas, but more importantly, my mom and I took it really to be a metaphor for the Amazon, the planet, like the Amazon jungle. But more importantly, James Cameron is obviously a very big fan of Japanese anime. Because he has been attached to a project and off and on Battle Angel Alita. But obviously he likes a lot of the films like Spirited Away and Ponyo, which do relate to man's relationship with nature and to the relationship of all living things on the planet, that we're all connected somehow.
Yeah.
And that's what I took that as. Now, what I'm curious, Jason, is you bring up a valid criticism about the mineral that we're fighting for in the future. Mm-hmm. But can't we be safe to assume that we did screw the planet up? We know that right now, living through these times, that in the future, and he's giving us 150 years in the future or something?
I think it's 21,
that we're still able to function?
I mean, but I would have loved to have seen that. I would have loved to have maybe a scene on Earth or something that we see what's happened. I just think it would have made it a lot more interesting to really create that kind of conflict in the audience to say, well, you know, because we so buy into it that obviously this bad guy is, you know, leading this charge to rape and pillage these people. So we're obviously on their side immediately. But why not make it a little more complex and see Earth in suffering? And
as it stands now, it is just a MacGuffin. And so I think the stakes could have been raised a lot more.
Okay.
if it wasn't. I like the environmental stuff.
Yeah.
That's something that I really got out of it.
Mm-hmm.
They're one with their environment, and like I said on Jason's show, their spirituality was in their environment, and the Americans were coming in and they were raping their land.
Not so much the Americans. It seemed I want to say the whole world. It was the planet Earth, humanity.
It was humanity. Yeah.
Well, humanity wasn't the thing that was driving tanks and everything through their environment.
I understand that. I understand that. But I was just trying. I think you may be taking it even further, the anti-American sentiment. You guys are taking further than.
Yeah,
but I understand where you're coming from, and I understand Jason's point. That's actually a valid criticism, because what I'm reading on Twitter over the weekend and on Facebook and in MySpace, you know, and all the different sites from the other film critics and everything that are bashing the film, I'm not getting that kind of detailed criticism. I'm getting a blanket thing like, oh, there's no story, there's no character, that sort of stuff. So I do appreciate what the two of you are saying. It's actually a very they're valid criticisms.
Yeah, and don't get me wrong. I mean, I'm not bashing the film. I mean, because I was, like I said, it's an amazing experience to watch it. I mean, it's just from a technical standpoint, you know, just being brought into the world. And like I told Jamie last night, I found myself looking at so much in the screen. It is such an awesome visual palette, you know, of what everything is going on. It's beautiful to experience.
Right.
I just wish that when you're spending that much money on a film, I just think, you know, we should challenge people a little bit more with a little, because I thought you see every step of the story coming. I mean, there's nothing
okay, no,
that's surprising.
That's fair. I understand.
If somebody is that genius at creating this world, and it's such a visionary world, then I shouldn't be able to paint by numbers his script. I mean, point for point.
Yeah, that's the biggest thing. It's just because here's an opportunity. You know, you're going to have this huge canvas for which to paint something on, and you could shade this thing with so much layers of a lot more edge and make it a lot more interesting. You know, that it would just, that's what I was hoping for. I was hoping for something groundbreaking, not just in visual effects, but in story as well.
Well,
that being said, I do think it's the movie event of the decade.
Yeah. Oh, but
not only because of the technology, but because of just the enormous vision behind it. I mean, little detail.
I wanted to actually bring up something Chris had brought up during the summer when we were talking about Transformers 2 and then this film coming out. Is that, you know, in between Titanic and this film, we've had Michael Bay, we've had Stephen Sommers, we've had the arrival of Paul W.S. Anderson, not to be confused with the genius P.T. Anderson. We've had these, like, schlockmeisters come about, but who have made these huge spectacles. And, you know, I've named these films specifically, the director of G.I. Joe and Transformers 2 specifically, that did very well this summer. The G.I. Joe, I can't understand why, because the movie looks like an unfinished print. When you go to see it in the theater, it looks like you spent that much money and the special effects look as good as the Land of the Lost TV series. That's great.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I understand where both of you are coming from, and it is a valid criticism, but still, and this is a lazy man's, like, almost compliment almost, but there is still more story in this than I've seen from kind of spectacle pictures over the last decade almost.
If this doesn't outgross Transformers 2, then I'm going to be super pissed.
Yeah.
Well, it's not, but anyway. I told Jamie, I'd rather have a filmmaker like James Cameron that is this bold to take these steps, because we don't have that many visionaries like that that are that bold.
We only have Peter Jackson and Del Toro, Guillermo del Toro.
And both of those guys bow at the altar of James Cameron.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I'd much rather, as much as, you know, it sounds like I might be criticizing the film, I'm really...
But you are.
You know,
I have too.
yeah, but we just expect more. It's sort of like when, you know, we've got a director like Steven Spielberg, we hold him to a higher standard. You know, so it's... But, I mean, I'd rather have a James Cameron making a movie than half the other directors that are working nowadays. That
I didn't walk out disappointed, really.
No, I didn't either. No.
No.
Kristen, any final... Because Chris has been, like, hushed out by the three of us going back.
No, I kept hoping Chris would come back in. I kept pointing.
Well, he's trying to find a place to.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, it's too difficult when there's all these people.
No, it's my fault, Chris. You can blame me for that one.
Yeah, I mean, there was probably about 20 things that were said that I could take umbrage with. I mean, I don't know what to say. This is what I mean. Like, everyone is sort of wanting to partially criticize the movie and then turn around in the same breath and say, but it's an absolutely amazing experience, and it's the film of the decade. Well, like, I mean, if you say it's an absolutely, if you're using those words, it's an absolutely amazing experience, that's exactly the way that it should be thought of, and I think that's what he was focused on. And I don't think that a movie that's, just because you spend $250 million on a movie, it needs to be more complex or more this, or it needs to be less obvious or more subtle. I don't think it needs to be. I think it needs to be an amazing experience. And as far as it seems like a lot of the complaints, not just from you guys, but from other people were, I wish it were more this, and I wish it had more of that, and I wish it had, sort of like projecting these things on the movie that you yourself have created with all of the hype and anticipation.
Do you think Cameron didn't want you to feel the transformation? Do you think he didn't want you to care about most of the characters?
I don't understand your question.
I didn't feel that way about it. So I'm not saying that I want it to be the movie that I want it to be, not the movie that Cameron intended it to be, because it's a failing of Cameron's as a writer. The transformation was sloppy. It seemed too sudden that the lead character
went through. What transformation? I don't know.
The transformation between opposer, oppressor, to liberator,
for Sam Worthington.
Oh,
okay.
I disagree. No, I disagree completely. No, I don't think that was too sudden. I mean, I think that was there was plenty of time, and he spent 3 months there with them. I mean, that was the amount of time that he spent there in the jungle.
Yeah, and he's constantly once he gets a groove going, it cuts back to real Earth. Once you feel like a flow is going there, and he's establishing a connection, it keeps going back.
Well, isn't that what you're asking for? You're saying you wish the movie was more complex. It's jumping back and forth between two different stories. You're saying you wish it would just be a blue guy running through the jungle for 3 months.
This is right here. It is complicated, actually. Much more complicated, and I'm not trying to plug Nancy Meyers' movie. That's the last thing I want to do. But it is complicated because there is that scene where Stephen Lang's character does show the video diary where Jake Sully makes that one where he said it's hopeless. I think Sully is actually conflicted through a good chunk on the first half of the film.
Very much so. I agree completely, Jerry. And yeah. Very conflicted also about his relationship with the Zoe Saldana character.
Mm-hmm.
A really, really powerful moment with his character where he says, Jake, where he wakes up in the thing and he says, Jake, what are you doing? Like,
yeah.
This is a real person. That's when he really starts to realize these people, it's not just some video game I'm playing here. Like, this is their entire world that we're fucking with, and I'm fucking with their world. And as far as it being predictable and simple, if you go back and watch, you've seen Star Wars 50 times, but if you go back and watch it now, you can map out every fucking thing that happens in that movie if you've never seen it before. It's the most simple fucking movie ever made. Forget about the trilogy. I'm talking about the first one, which essentially can be broken down into bad guy kills little boy's parents, so he goes and blows up bad guy's ship. Like, that's
and,
the fucking
and
movie.
And that's why I liked Star Wars as a 6-year-old. And I don't find much enjoyment out of it as a 36-year-old.
Okay. What about King Kong? What about Wizard of Oz?
Never. Which King Kong?
Well, I'm talking about the original King
the
Kong.
The original King Kong.
Or the new King Kong. Those are extremely simple movies. Or, by the way, you want to talk about simple movies, Dances with Wolves, which has drawn a million comparisons here. But that
I never liked Dances with Wolves.
I like Dances with Wolves, too, and I do see the comparison.
Yeah.
And that movie is simple, and one of the reasons it works is because it's simple. It appeals to everyone. You don't need a fucking PhD to figure it out. You don't need a, you know, it's not a Rubik's Cube, you know? Like, I don't...
Thinking like Dances with Wolves, the one point I made about Dances with Wolves, and we're talking about the transformation of the character, don't you think the transformation of John Dunbar in Dances with Wolves, you really truly believe that transformation because it really... takes the time to really analyze why he changes into what he does.
It does exactly what I just said. Instead of flashing back and forth between two areas, it just is him in the middle of the fucking prairie with the Indians. Like, if you spend 3.5 hours with one character, yeah, you're going to know exactly what's going on in his mind. Like, you're going to really understand.
Gentlemen, there's actually a very... I like the scene where Sigourney Weaver finds out that Jake has slept with the Zoe Saldana character, and she's like, oh, shit.
Yeah.
That is actually a wake-up call, because she's not aware of even what's going on. And I think it's not as George W. Bush simple as you think it is. It actually is some layers of complexity here, and I definitely want to watch it again, but... And Chris brings up a good point. Dance with Wolves is pretty obvious, and Dance with Wolves owes a lot to Lawrence of Arabia. And even Lawrence of Arabia realized, hey, you know he's going to go native. And John Dunbar goes native. And guess what? Jake Sully goes native. It's no secret, but it's how it's done in each film is I find pretty remarkable. The catalyst for that.
Yeah, I mean, it's how it's done. And that's I guess, my criticism of Avatar. I just felt like it didn't really convince me enough of the point where this transition was taking place.
Okay.
That's all. I think we can all agree, though, isn't Zoe Saldana the hottest blue person of the year?
I don't know. I mean, I'm kind of really jealous of Dr. Manhattan's member enhancement in Watchmen. But
well,
okay,
that's true.
Yeah,
he'd be
right.
A close second, yeah.
Yeah. No, Zoe, she's hot. I mean, Zoe Saldana's very hot. There's no doubt about that. Even as a blue person.
Oh, yeah.
Jason, are you getting divorced after this show? Is your wife hear this?
No.
Okay.
All right, let's get to Golden Globes.
Thank God.
Yes.
They happened Sunday, January 17th. The Oscar nominations are announced February 2nd, so there's a lot of leeway time between these things. So a lot of perceptions can change between then and Oscar time. But the Golden Globes, let's go through these nominees quickly and see what our thoughts are about them. They have, I don't know. Okay, let's start with the top thing since we've been talking Avatar. Let's start with motion picture. Avatar nominated, The Hurt Locker nominated, Inglourious Basterds, Precious, and Up in the Air. Now, the Hollywood Foreign Press is crazy about Avatar.
Mm-hmm.
I think it could have a shot at winning a Golden Globe for Best Picture, actually. A Golden Globe. What do you think, Chris?
You said you thought the movie would win Best Picture at the Oscars also, did you not?
No, I said it would have the most nominations, including Best Picture at the Oscars.
Yeah, I don't think he went so far as to predict it to win yet.
I don't know if he said that on the air, but I'm pretty sure he
said
that.
No, I did that. We've been saying that for the past year.
Oh, my God. Are you guys going to fight about it? I agree.
I think it's got a really good chance of winning Best Picture. Yeah.
The Hurt Locker, that's gaining momentum. So is Bastards. Precious is falling away in momentum, if by what I'm reading, for whatever reason. But Up in the Air has a big shot, too, even though I despise that movie.
Why? Let me ask you this. Why do you despise the movie so much? And we'll talk about this on another show at more detail, but I'm just curious. What was it about this movie that you didn't like? I'm just curious. I mean...
It wasn't...
Don't say too simple.
Because I actually say this contains some of the best performances of the year. I mean, acting-wise.
I completely agree.
I mean,
and one of the best screenplays of the year, if not the best.
Screenplay is smarmy. The screenplay is, oh God, look how clever I am, which is true of all Jason Reitman films. But it really bothered me here.
Wait, how is this true in all Jason Reitman films?
Juno isn't pleased with itself.
Oh,
Juno isn't a
okay. Oh my God, Jamie, this is going to be a 5-hour show. No, because you have here with Jason Reitman, yes. He does have the famous father, but he proved himself a Thank You for Smoking. That's Christopher Buckley. Juno's Diablo Cody. This is Walter Kern. Now, granted, in Up in the Air, he adds a lot of things that aren't in the original novel. But swarmy? Do we really want to use that word?
Apparently I did, because I used it.
No, yes, I know that. God, it was a rhetorical question, but Jesus fucking Christ. I mean, this movie, I have to tell you something. This movie has pulled some punches, and it pulls some very good punches. And I think it's good. I mean, do I think it's the best movie of the year? I don't know, but it's damn good.
It pulls no punches
for you because it ain't fucking clean and sober, okay? That's what it's not, okay? But it's a good fucking movie for Clooney.
Do you want to hear my opinion, or do you want to keep... jabbing.
Go give me your opinion, because I think this is the let's go after Clooney year, okay?
It's not go after Clooney. I like Clooney. Clooney is a movie star. I loved him in Michael Clayton. He does nothing new here.
But
he's good here.
He plays a despicable character who goes around. His job is to fire people for weasel bosses who can't do it themselves. But he is a despicable character. It isn't until the third act that he turns around.
Well, he wasn't lovable in Michael Clayton. He's
despicable there. But there's he has.
Wait a minute. Am I the only one who I don't think he's a despicable character in this movie.
No, but he actually, Jason. I'm talking about his occupation. But he is. There is something despicable, you know, in his actions. But he gets his ass handed to him by Anna Kendrick because she's even worse. We'll do it through the internet. We'll make it even colder. Like, there is this disturbing theme in the movie that if you fire the person in person, actually, as opposed to via the internet, it's better. But it's still a despicable thing that these people engage in. It isn't until you feel for him, though, when he's in the third act where he really gets, you know, everything handed to him.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so do we all think that Avatar will win Best Picture at the Golden Globe?
No.
I think it's between The Hurt Locker and Avatar.
I actually think Inglourious Basterds is going to win the Golden Globe.
Really?
You really do?
I actually think it's on a huge rise. I think it's going to be – The Hurt Locker and Inglourious Basterds are the two that are on the biggest rise. I think Up in the Air is probably going to peak here at some point now that it's going to open wide and depending on how it's received by audiences. So I just have this feeling that, you know, Inglourious Basterds is going to get this huge push and get the Golden Globe for best motion picture drama, yes.
It's a bingo.
I think every one of them has a shot except for Precious.
You really think?
Yeah, because you're right about Precious.
Already?
It's kind
you
of falling.
Think, you think Precious has really peaked?
Yeah.
Okay. That's a fair
yeah, assessment. I actually do. And Monique is not helping it by her her lack of Oscar campaigning.
And up in the air is way up in the air when it still belongs on the tarmac. best motion picture, musical, or comedy. Some good movies here. 500 Days of Summer, The Hangover, It's Complicated, Julie and Julia, 9. Chris, have you seen, obviously none of us have seen It's Complicated, but have you seen some of these?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I've seen Julia, Hangover, and 500 Days of Summer.
Yeah.
So I have not seen It's Complicated, obviously, or 9. And frankly, I don't really want to see 9, but I do want to see It's Complicated.
Yeah.
But I don't think any of it matters because I think that The Hangover is a lock. So.
Yep,
I think going just for the comedy aspect, because I don't think 500 Days of Summer is a comedy. I'm not even, you know.
No, I don't either.
You know, so I think it's a wrong, but I think it belongs to The Hangover, and it should win because it is the funniest movie of the year.
Absolutely, I agree.
Yep.
Yeah.
And I didn't like The Hangover either.
Dude, you've got some balls to interview with him. I love this. I love this side that's coming out of you. This is awesome.
Best performance by an actor in a motion picture.
Well, wait, Jamie, what's your prediction then if it's not going to be The Hangover winning?
Oh, my favorite movie out of all these movies is 500 Days of Summer.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's
my
favorite, but I don't know if it's going to
win. I like 500 Days of Summer more, too. I'm just saying, which one do you think will win?
Yeah.
I don't see them giving it to The Hangover.
Why not?
Really?
Any more than I would see them giving it to an Apatow movie.
Let me see. Do you think they'll give it to Julie and Julia?
I think that probably has a chance more than any. Well, no. No, no, no. I'm sorry. They're going to give it to 9.
You think they're going to give it to 9?
Yeah.
I don't think 9 is going to open strong at all.
No.
Yeah.
Nine.
Well,
Evita
didn't either, but they gave
well.
It to Evita.
I think if
you're a musical, they'll probably pick you over.
If you have more than 5 minutes of music in a film show.
Or over a drunken comedy. best performance by an actor in a motion picture drama. I love this category, except for one of their inclusions.
Of course.
Jeff Bridges, George Clooney, Colin Firth, Morgan Freeman, and Tobey Maguire.
He lobbied hard for that.
Man, he really stuck his neck out, and Tobey Maguire does not have a neck. Have you noticed that? He's all chin. I think, you know, I'm in love with Jeff Bridges. I think that this is Jeff Bridges' year all the way. That's what I'm praying.
I think so. I think it really, I think it's between Bridges, but I think Colin Firth is a dark horse.
Yeah.
Yeah, he could be.
Are you hoping for a Jeff Bridges win, Chris, all throughout this season?
Yeah, pretty much. I've always been less impressed by George Clooney than you have. It's not that I dislike George Clooney. I just don't feel like George Clooney is capable of hitting anything above an 8, you know? Like, I feel he very consistently hits an 8, but very rarely hits above an 8, you know what I mean? That he kind of tops out there.
He's a movie star. I'm not sure how good of an actor he is.
Right. I love
really
him in certain movies. I think he's great in Out of Sight, but you know, he's George Clooney great. He's not capable of the kind of I have not seen that he is capable of the kind of nuanced performances that some of these other guys in this category are, like Jeff Bridges and Colin Firth and Morgan Freeman. Forget about Tobey Maguire.
Yeah, I know the Tobey Maguire thing. That's a shocker. That was a shocker that morning.
It's not a shocker though, because this always happens at the Golden Globes. They sort
yeah.
of gamble. They sort of gamble on movies that feel like they're going to be contenders, and there's always a couple like this every year with the Golden Globe nomination.
Well, about Clooney though, I would say that he is nuanced as Bob Bear or the Bob Bear inspired character in Syriana. I do think that's a nuanced performance.
I thought that was a John Dunbar kind of conformity.
Okay, if you want to say John, I mean, but it's not. But, I mean, I understand where you...
It belonged in Avatar.
Okay, yeah, George Clooney and Avatar. I think Michael Clayton, Daniel Day-Lewis wasn't nominated that year. I think he would have won for Michael Clayton, and I would have given it to him for Michael Clayton because that's just an incredible performance. But
okay, so Shelley and I both agree, and Jason does not, that I just wanted to stack the odds against Jason here.
Yeah, thank you.
That Jeremy Renner...
Band of Outsiders?
Jeremy Renner will be nominated for Best Actor Oscar.
Oh, without a doubt.
And he was excluded here in favor of Tobey Maguire, and that is a major oversight in the Globe's part.
I agree with that 100%.
Thank you.
Yeah, I don't think... Yeah.
Anyway, well, Jason, who would you put in if not Tobey Maguire?
Or Jeremy Renner.
I keep saying Michael Stuhlbarg, but Jamie keeps making fun of me about it, but...
Stuhlbarg. That's like Shakespeare's bowel movement.
For a serious
Stuhlbarg.
Man?
Yeah, for a serious man.
Is he not in the comedy and... He's in
well, I'm talking about for the Oscar, if I'm putting
he
in
could.
An Oscar nominee.
He is the... If you're going to nominate someone from that movie, he's the person you nominate.
I think that
movie's currency is over. I don't think anybody's talking about that movie.
The Academy
for
always does
for
one
Jews.
Nomination that we didn't see coming. And I think that's going to be where it is.
Okay.
But anyway, that's a discussion for another time. But the only thing to consider about the Globes is the only reason I think Clooney might have a chance is the Globes love their stars. That's why they nominated Robert Downey Jr. for Sherlock Holmes, for Christ's sake. So they like those star-making moments. So that's the interesting thing about predicting the Golden Globes. You know, they're not always as, you know, they're not always picking for the art of the of the thing. So,
yeah,
you know, that's where
He's
Colin Firth would stand
is
less of a
chance. Right about that. You're absolutely right, Jason.
It's the big
best performance
show. So.
That's yeah,
Boy,
they're all drunk.
Scary saying I'm right. I like this.
They're
no,
all
but
drunk.
You're right about they really do bank. They're on bankability, on box office. Really.
Oh, yeah.
That's why you got a Sandra Bullock double nomination here.
Yep, for the proposal.
Best performance by an actress in a motion picture drama: Emily Blunt's Young Victoria, Sandra Bullock, The Blind Side, Helen Mirren, The Last Station, Carey Mulligan in Education, Gabori Gabby Sidibe for Precious.
You're really having a field day with her name.
I'm glad I got it.
I'm
proud of you. I'm not going to stop saying it. This is the Globes for you. I think at the Globes, Sandra Bullock has a shot, but I think they're going to give it to Sidibe. Actually,
I do too, and I think she's actually the front runner for the Oscar too.
I think here's my thing: if we were going to do who do I think's going to win, I think Bullock's going to win. Who do I want to win? Blunt for the Young Victoria because she plays against types. She's used to playing like a really like smart ass sometimes and. Very with it, very, and she's just perfect as Queen Victoria. She's
Chris,
awesome.
you having seen Precious, do you think she's got a shot, especially at the Globes where they love to, well, the Oscars too, they love to discover someone, and at the beginning of their career, like bestow an Oscar upon them, which is almost a death knell for a career.
Yeah, I was about to say, you say discover them, I say begin forgetting them.
Yes.
She's absolutely got a shot here. She's absolutely got a shot at the Oscar. But I happen to think that Sandra Bullock will win it too. And quite frankly, I saw The Blind Side, and I can't believe I'm saying this, but it was not a bad movie. In fact, it was pretty good.
Yeah.
If a little mm-hmm. bit formulaic and predictable, but not overly so. I mean, it was a decent movie, and this really is the best performance she's ever given. She's extremely believable and extremely likable, and I know people always describe her as being likable, but I have the opposite reaction to her typically.
Mm-hmm.
And I liked her very much in this movie, and I thought she was
do
very
drama
genuine.
More often.
Yeah, well, sort of light drama.
You're right, but she was, I actually did find the film, it wasn't as painful an experience as I thought it would be.
No, I ended up...
What a rage.
I mean, you know, I'm trying to be honest here, Jamie. Just
I
work
no, but that, that'll look perfect. Great on the poster, dude. Not as painful as I thought it would be.
I thought it... And I know I've used dude... We've used dude twice in addressing each other. Michelle McHugh is right, though. Mulligan is a good chance that she may very well win. And I would not...
She would be a discovery, too. I mean, she would be... Fall into that category.
It's just people have seen in Education. Two people. I mean, that's the thing I keep saying about that film. It's just there's not enough people that are going to see it to where it's going to be a viable contender.
But no, the Academy has seen it though.
Oh, I know, but still enough to win. I don't think so. I certainly
think. I think that with the Precious Girl, she feels like, and
Precious Girl,
she feels like an unlikely person to be in this category. I mean, and this position. So I think that that makes a big story that the Oscars love.
The Oscars, I think she's got the better chance because I think there is this sense that this is Sandra Bullock's year. I mean, she was the number one entertainer of the year in Entertainment Weekly's year end, you know, and all the talk is about Sandra Bullock. You know, so I think from the Globe's perspective, they probably will give it to her here.
Mm-hmm.
But I think when it comes to the Oscars, they're going to look at it more seriously. Sandra Bullock may get the nomination, but I think Sadaibi is probably the winner in this category.
You don't think I should go watch All About Steve?
Chris, go ahead.
Doesn't it seem a little bit, and I'm not directing this at anyone in particular, but doesn't it seem a little bit condescending and almost slightly racist that we're all going crazy about how unpredictable it was that she would be in this position, you know?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, the only reason that anyone is saying that is because she's incredibly overweight and she's a black woman. And I think everyone's sort of just skimming past that.
How often does that happen?
Well, that's true. And I'm not disagreeing with you. I do think it's incredibly unlikely. I just am pointing out that I think it's a little strange that it's sort of blatantly condescending and a little bit racist.
No, it
well,
is.
I actually don't think
right
that it's not an unlikely thing. I think it's I saw Precious, and I think it's an amazing performance. She'd probably be my choice for the best lead actress performance of the year.
And she could be. She could be. But how many movies are made about overweight African American women and their lead.
Oh, true. I know.
Oh my God,
unique,
Jamie,
I mean,
we shouldn't be having this conversation. We're three white guys. Come on. All right,
you,
no.
You don't. You don't know what movies are made?
I know where Chris is coming from, and you know, we
this
all.
This isn't a racial discussion. This is. I don't write the movies. I'm telling you what movies are being written. This isn't a character we get to see a lot of.
No,
it's
not
unique.
No, it is unique, but I think I understand where Chris is coming from, and we all knew that this film would come into play because this is one of the films from the last Sundance that got an enormous amount of buzz. Mm-hmm. And there's no doubt when you watch the film, it's a powerful film. All the performances are very good, but hers is really the standout. I know people are making because Monique is the name brand, and it's Monique playing a role that we're not used to seeing because she hasn't played a role like this. But all the performances are very good, and let's not forget Mariah Carey. An unrecognizable Mariah Carey.
Yeah. Excellent.
Yeah.
Which is the best way to take Mariah Carey. Best
and we're
performance.
Get so much hate now in an hour.
Best performance by an actor in a motion picture, musical, or comedy. Matt Damon for The Informant. Daniel Day-Lewis for Nine. Robert Downey Jr. for Sherlock Holmes, that musical or comedy Sherlock Holmes. Joseph Gordon-Levitt for 500 Days of Summer. And Michael Stuhlbarg for A Dangerous Man.
A serious man.
I'm sorry.
I think this might go to Matt Damon or Robert Downey Jr. because of the star.
No
they
kidding.
Like stars a lot.
It's funny because I think this is the one category where I think Michael Stuhlbarg is the only man in this category who has a legitimate chance of getting an Oscar category, yet somehow I think he has the least chance of winning the Golden Globe. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I would give it to him, Chris, for this. I would give it to him. As much as I love Joseph Gordon-Levitt, because I think it's really his movie, 500 Days of Summer, it's his story. It's definitely Tom Hansen's story, and we perceive everything through his eyes. Michael's character in A Serious Man, he's our anchor in that story. It's the worst day of anyone's life, and we, you know, his performance, and it is an ensemble cast, but it's his performance that really grounds that movie. I would, you know, in a perfect world, it's really, for me, between Stuhlbarg and Levitt and no one else.
Who do you think will get it, Jason?
I actually think because of the Globes, it's going to be a Matt Damon victory.
I think because of the Globes, it'll be Daniel Day-Lewis. So we're all in disagreement. It's a running theme in the show.
But if the movie's that poorly received, which it is already, and at box office-wise, it might not be. This could be one of those things where you look at Monday morning and it's number 7 or number 8.
It's not gonna matter the Globes.
Okay.
How is
all
it
right.
possible that Robert Downey Jr. is nominated in this? How is that even possible?
Exactly, exactly.
That's exactly what my reaction was.
Almost no one has seen that movie. Almost no one has seen it. And this is what I was talking about with Tobey Maguire. Like, they sort of roll the dice on these types of things.
Well, that's the goal.
You don't think
anyone's
seen, in the Hollywood Foreign Press, has even seen the movie?
They might have had a chance, but it was screened for critics after the nominations came out.
Oh, right. Yeah. Well, I did not know that.
But that's what the Globes, they don't care. I mean, they may have not, half of them may not have even seen it, but they're going to nominate him because it's Robert Downey Jr., and he'll get to be in the crowd, and they'll have their big star-studded night. He's a great, you know, person to have there because of his comeback story.
Right.
So, I mean,
right.
That's the thing about the Globes that's always kind of the criticism. It's the big party show, and they want to populate it with as many stars as possible.
One in particular who's not allowed to drink.
<That's right.
laughs> You had to remind him.
Who's that? Robin Williams?
Robert Downey Jr. No, Robert Downey.
Oh, you're right.
Well, that's another nomination. I would have nominated Robin Williams for World's Greatest Dad. I mean, I'm not.
That's actually one of the surprises of the year.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Best performance by an actor in a musical or a comedy actress. Sandra Bullock, The Proposal. Marion Cotillard for Nine. Julia Roberts for Duplicity.
Where did they pull that out? That's what I want
again. Get the stars there. Going to have Julia Roberts.
You know, you're right. I understand that.
Yeah. Meryl Streep for It's Complicated and for Julie and Julia.
One of the two Streep roles.
Yeah.
It's going to be Streep
Julia,
for Julie
Julia.
And Julia.
Yeah,
I agree, Chris.
Julia. Once again, It's Complicated. Nobody has seen the thing, or very few people have seen it. I mean, there are reviews of this movie out, but
mm-hmm.
how many people could have possibly seen it? They wanted her twice in the same category. And I want to defend Julia Roberts here for a second. Number one, I thought Duplicity was one of the more underrated movies of the year. And number two, I did think this was a pretty good performance from her. Probably not worthy of a nomination.
It's a good performance, but I think for me the film just fizzles towards the end. That's my major problem. It just doesn't go anywhere.
A little bit, maybe. But it's certainly not the joke of this category.
The joke
is Sandra Bullock from The
Proposal.
Proposal.
Yeah, you're right.
I mean, but you knew that was coming, Chris, when you didn't even need it. You knew that was coming.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not a joke. I mean, I think we're just surprised at Julia Roberts that they can think that far back, because when I think of the Globe, it's usually something that's come within the last 2 months.
I think it has more to do with what Jason was talking about. I mean, I think that's really what that is. That's what helped them remember her, is that she's Julia Roberts.
I think it'll definitely be Julie and Julia. And it's a real good performance. I enjoyed her very much in it. There's a lot of joy in that performance, you know. It's fully alive. She's just great, you know. And in terms of It's Complicated, reviews have started to come in, and actually – if the movie's called It's Complicated, but the reviews make it sound really freaking simple.
Well, there have been a lot of nasty things about Nancy Meyers over the last couple of days.
But it's a movie you watch for the reason why you watch most Nancy Meyer movies. The chemistry between the stars, between the actors. You enjoy their company.
That's why you go to see it?
I think that's why you would go see a movie called It's Complicated, because you enjoy those people together. You enjoy being in their company.
Okay.
It's complicated.
I think that's true of most Nancy Meyers movies, actually.
No, she likes, you know, according to what the criticism is, she does not realize that there are people who don't live in big houses and aren't white.
Right. Well, that's true. Maybe she should, okay. Best performance.
Just stop there.
By an actor in a supporting role, Matt Damon for Invictus. Have you seen that yet, Chris? Is that around here yet?
That's everywhere.
Oh, yeah. It's playing here, but I just can't bring myself to go see it. Like, I just it's one of those things it's like when a Mike Lee movie comes out. Like, I know it's good.
It's not, Chris. It's actually not as it's pretty good. It's like a thinking person's Blind Side.
Yeah, you know, I'll see it eventually. I'm not going to go pay $10 and go see it, most likely.
Okay, but it's not. It's actually pretty good. The second half is the rugby scenes are really, really well done.
See it the same way we watch Gran Torino, Chris.
Yeah, I will be, actually.
Yeah.
That's how I saw Blind Side. Yeah.
Oh, okay, I have to look that up. Woody Harrelson in The Messenger, Christopher Plummer in The Last Station, Stanley Tucci in The Lovely Bones, Christoph Waltz in Inglourious Basterds, which we're all in agreement he's taken home, right?
Yeah, this belongs to Waltz.
He's waltzing home with it.
Yeah, I mean, this category,
so well-deserved too.
He owns this category.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, It's the only acting nomination I see Inglourious Basterds getting, actually, at the Oscars. It's been talked about since before the movie actually was seen by any of us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think Inglourious Basterds is one of the movies of the, one of the accomplishments of the year, and I think it needs.
I would actually say the decade, but that's just me.
I think it's going to
be. No, I agree with you, Jerry.
I think it's going to be represented well at the Oscars, personally.
I do too.
I think so too, but not for the reasons we're thinking.
Yeah, I mean, as long as it's represented.
It's going to be represented for the one reason that we've criticized these kind of films in the past. It's a movie. It is the, in that sense, it is the, if, all right, the Academy voters are older, mostly Jewish, older. This is every fucking fantasy every Jewish boy has had for the longest time. You better fucking believe this movie is going to be well represented, like, you know, up the yin-yang at this thing.
You think because Hollywood is a Jewish town that...
No, I think because it's that, but, you know, you all criticize, everyone when there's a Holocaust movie up, oh, it's a Holocaust movie, it's going to be get, it's certainly going to get nominated. Well, okay,
yeah.
Here you have something where Quentin Tarantino said to Jeffrey Goldberg in the Atlantic Monthly, I wanted to make a movie where the Jews weren't the victims.
Right.
Okay? And that's going to resonate with everyone. And it has, obviously, his highest grossing film since Pulp Fiction.
And how bad does Jacob the Liar have to be to not have been nominated for anything?
Or Defiance.
Yeah,
Defiance
right.
is essentially Red Dawn, a remake of Red Dawn. But, you know, it's, you know, he was asked about Defiance, and he said, no, I haven't seen it, but I bet they don't go far enough like I do.
Yeah, there's no way that he's going to, that guy's, what's his name? The one that, Ed Zwick. Okay.
Ed Zwick isn't going to go. I mean, this really, I mean, Quentin Tarantino is basically, he went to Eli Roth and asked him all these questions. Well, what did Jews do? What does this do? What happens here? What's this? What would happen here? And, you know, everyone knows that this week Eli Roth's father was interviewed, and he said he couldn't stop crying at the scene where Eli Roth, you know, does the most heroic deed in, I guess you could say, Jewish fantasy fiction here, and
yeah.
kills its most evil character. So
I like that Woody Harrelson was nominated. I would have,
yeah.
you know, a lot more talk has been dedicated to Ben Foster in The Messenger.
He should
Woody
be nominated.
Yeah, Woody Harrelson gives probably his most sensitive performance, as I've understood it.
Mm-hmm.
But Ben Foster is really like a he's arrived in that movie. He's done good work before, but this is a real.
This is, mm-hmm. you know, it's a shame because he's really it's a powerful performance, and Woody Harrelson. Like I said, if it wasn't Inglourious Basterds this year, I would give the best supporting to Woody Harrelson, no problem, for The Messenger. Hands down.
Good conversation going on between Michelle and Miss Movie Fan. Actually, the two Michelles in the chat room. Okay, best performance by an actress in a supporting role. Penelope Cruz in Nine. Vera Farmiga in Up in the Air. Anna Kendrick for Up in the Air. Monique for Precious, Julianne Moore for Single Man. You know, before this, these past few weeks, I would have said Monique, but not now. she's basically
she's
spitting
not helping
at
herself.
Yeah, she's spitting at their face, big time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she is not the type that's doing the Oscar campaigning or anything. Even though she's winning a lot of it, this is actually an interesting category. This is a tough one.
I think it's between the two up in the air actresses. Personally.
Yeah, I was going to say Anna Kendrick is probably the one that's got more of the chance just because...
It's up in the air between the two of them?
Yes, it is, Jamie.
Chris, do you have a feeling on this?
Yeah, I have a feeling it's the most boring category in the entire show.
It's not like previous years.
No, I'll be more interested in, you know...
You'll be refilling your
art
drink
direction.
During this one.
Yeah, I'll be refilling my drink, absolutely. Now, you know, I don't know. I would probably tend to agree with you, probably either Vera Farmiga, whatever the fuck her name is, for Up in the Air. The hot chick in the panties from The Departed, or Anna Kendrick, I would imagine.
I think it's between those two.
Yeah, although I wouldn't, you know, like, maybe they will give it to Monique. You know, that kind of stuff can sometimes be...
Make for great television.
Not only make television, but people tend to make too much of that kind of stuff sometimes, and they end up getting nominated in anyway, you know.
That's true. It's like the year George C. Scott badmouthed the Academy, and he won for Patton.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So it can happen.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't make too much of this. I mean, she didn't.
Maybe Monique will win, and she'll bring up Sasheen Littlefeather.
Yeah, that would be awesome, man.
Yeah,
that'd be great.
Best director, great, good category this year, all around from these from the selection pool that they have. Catherine Bigelow for Hurt Locker, James Cameron for Avatar, Battle of the Exes, Clint Eastwood for Evictus, Jason Reitman for Up in the Air, and Quentin Tarantino for Inglourious Bastards. I think this is. I think this might be essentially the Oscar category too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Unless they leave Cameron out.
Oh, I think Cameron will get nominated.
I'd be surprised.
I think got $100 riding on it.
Tom Ford might get nominated for A Single Man.
Yeah,
that's the thing. I think that they might really go for Tom Ford over.
Or Lee Daniels for Precious is what I'm.
Yeah, those are two. I wouldn't. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Lee Daniels is another one that. Or you know we tend to forget the Academy's different in that regard than the Hollywood Foreign Press. It could be Oren Moverman for The Messenger. I mean, I wouldn't rule out any of these.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing about the Golden Globes. Again, they're looking for names, and mm-hmm. James Cameron is one of the biggest director names there are.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you know, that makes sense to me that they nominated him there, but I just don't see Cameron getting a Best Director nomination.
I'm going out on a limb.
You don't see that as the directing achievement of the year? What he's done with that technology? Or
well,
even if you don't see it as the directing achievement of the year, you really don't think he'll get a nomination?
I don't. I think there's that egomania that people know about.
They
him.
Love that though, Jason.
Well, I know they love that, but I'm just saying that you know when they get down to sitting there nominating the directors, they're going to be thinking of films like Precious. Remember, this is the Academy. They're looking for the film that is the more serious kind of.
These are older people
thing like
too.
That. Look what they did last year, Christopher Nolan with The Dark Knight. I think we all agreed that, or I don't know if we all agreed, but I know that was one of the best directed efforts of the year,
mm-hmm.
and they didn't nominate him.
Well, look, they didn't direct Eastwood for Gran Torino either, so, I mean... Yeah.
Well, I think that Cameron will be nominated because the accomplishment is just far too great.
Yeah, I think that's a little bit too cynical. I think they look at the accomplishment first, and then with what's left over, when there's no other great accomplishments, then they go to the guys who directed the little, you know, movies about fat black chicks or whatever, you know?
Yeah, it's not about that, but, I mean, like, if they're going by ego, I mean, it's not like David O. Russell's up for anything.
Well, I know.
Well,
he's
got to make a good movie first. I mean, that being said, I think that this is. I think she'll win the Globe, and I think Cameron has a shot winning the Globe. But if I had to bet, I would say that Catherine Bigelow will win both the Globe and the Oscar for Best Director.
Well, I'm not going to bet against that.
Isn't that kind of
a good bet?
Honestly,
I'm telling you,
Chris, what were you saying?
As a directing achievement. Now, don't get me wrong. I love The Hurt Locker. In fact, I love all the movies in this category.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
As a directing achievement, as rewarding someone's work, is what Catherine Bigelow did with The Hurt Locker in any way on par with the job that James Cameron undertook? And by all accounts, even your own, even with your retarded mealy-mouth complaints about the movie, did you... You guys even admit that it is, your words, an amazing experience. We all love The Hurt Locker. The Hurt Locker was a damn good movie, and yeah, that guy was a badass. But we didn't walk out and say it was an incredibly amazing experience.
But let me ask you, I mean, comparing the director of a $250 million film with the director
of
a smaller budget.
Don't put that on me. Don't put that on me. There's five categories.
I actually have something to say about it.
We have to compare them. That's what they do. That's what the Oscars do.
I know.
They compare them.
But what I'm saying is I think a director that's got a smaller budget. I mean, if I had $250 million, I'd direct probably the best movie ever made. But, I mean,
but it's not just about how much money you had
and
what
you did. No, I'm not saying it's the money.
I'd direct the greatest porno ever made. But.
No, well, I'm not saying it's the money. I'm saying that... Look at the directorial achievement in everything that you had to do. What if you were limited by money, you know, and you still produced something that was incredibly unique? I think Catherine Bigelow is a better director of the year over James Cameron, because I think what she did with The Hurt Locker is a lot more.
I'd like to actually address something here about both of these.
Go ahead, Jay.
Thank you. I think it's the irony here, and Chris brings up a very good point, because The Hurt Locker is really the first – I like Stop Loss, Kimberly Beers' Stop Loss, but The Hurt Locker is truly the first successful film of the Iraq War to deal with it head on. It is a very good film. But one of the reasons it's very successful is because she sort of let the politics fall by the wayside. The very interesting thing about Avatar, it is the first successful film to deal with the politics of our situation in this decade. And he might have made, in one sense, as far as the political undertone goes, the more successful film. Now, not that the Academy looks at something like that, but I would not rule out James Cameron winning this category. Just, I think it's a very strong possibility.
I think the breadth of the achievement of Cameron's, I do think he deserves it more than anyone else. I was saying Catherine Bigelow, I think, will win the Globe and the Oscar.
Also, we can't confuse directing with writing, which we tend to do sometimes. People tend to say the way Catherine Bigelow dealt with this subject matter. Catherine Bigelow did not write this movie.
Mark
Bowl wrote the movie.
True.
But again, director
so
has control over everything. So I mean, director,
directing achievement only.
Right,
no.
But I mean, director is control of the story. I mean, it's you obviously have your writing achievement, but the way that that story is told and shaped is everything by the director, and that's where I think James Cameron falters because he doesn't have control over a really good story.
But
that's just my
we just had a conversation 15 minutes ago about Nancy Meyers. It's complicated. And what we all seem to agree on was you don't go see this movie for the story. You go to see it for the chemistry between these characters. There's certain movies you go to see for a certain reason. There's certain movies you go to see for a different reason. You go see L.A. Confidential because you know it's going to be an incredibly deep, layered story with lots of interesting characters. You don't go see a movie that's got a two-minute preview with blue people running from things blowing up. Because you're expecting, and by the way, did anyone not think that he was going to join them and become one of them? Didn't we all know that from the beginning?
No.
You know what I mean?
I thought that was a given, I mean, but that's just me.
Yeah, we knew that.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, Chris, I'm with you here. It is like these complaints. I don't know, man. I mean.
Anyway, am I the only one that thinks Quentin Tarantino has a shot here?
I think Quentin Tarantino has a great shot here, but
I mean, there's a chance here for this might be the best opportunity Quentin Tarantino has to win not only here but a Best Director Oscar.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, like I said, I think Inglourious Basterds is going to do nothing but rise, and I think that gives him a great chance. I mean, he's certainly, along with Cameron, one of the most well-known directors in the category. He's certainly a name; people know him, and you know this could be their opportunity to honor him with that.
I think the specialness of The Hurt Locker is the way it's directed.
I agree with you there, totally.
Yeah. I'm not saying that Cameron doesn't deserve it. I'm just telling you who I think they'll give it to. Because it's a particular story, too, of her taking this award. I think that will play better in the media, too, the story of that. And she, in many ways, she's the female Cameron.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I won't argue with that. And, like I said, I love The Hurt Locker. It's absolutely one of my favorite movies of the year. It's one of my five favorites. If I had to pick five best, it would be in that category.
Right.
I just don't think, as a directing achievement, I just don't think it's anywhere near on this. First of all, I don't think she did anything special that wasn't done before. I think she just did the same thing, just better. The same thing James Cameron did. Didn't do anything that, wait, no. We can't fucking say that because he absolutely did something that no one's ever done before.
Yeah.
All right.
None of us said otherwise.
Does anybody think Clint Eastwood?
So you're saying I should just ignore the story when I watch Avatar?
I don't think this is Clint Eastwood.
That's not what
here.
I'm saying. That's not what I'm saying at all.
I was trying to be.
But I like the movie though.
I just can't help what I feel. I didn't feel anything for what I was seeing in Avatar. I didn't feel the journey. And that's a personal thing.
But I don't know. Maybe what's confusing me is I do feel like we sort of have seen too much about this movie before we went and saw it. As movie geeks, you know, I do think that oftentimes we bring too much to movies. I do think
you're right.
we're sort of immersed in the movie too long before we go and see it. I have not talked to anyone else outside the movie geek realm, you know, who didn't come away as anything but blown away. And if I would go to these people and say, didn't you feel like the C story arc was a little weak, or didn't you feel – they'd be like, what the fuck are you talking about?
Yeah, no,
like,
you're right, Chris.
But you're not on the phone with those people right now. You're on the phone with people that actually know what that is.
Yeah, but it's – I know where Chris is coming from, and you know, I'm not going to say it now, but I know it's addressed perfectly in Inglourious Basterds what Chris is trying to say, and I'm just not even going to go to the scene. But there is a scene where Tarantino rips all movie geeks a new asshole.
Best screenplay, motion picture. This is a good. This is nice. District 9 got nominated.
Mm-hmm.
The Hurt Locker, Inglourious Basterds. It's complicated. Up in the air. It should be Inglourious Basterds, I think. But
I think it's going to be that. But I also think District 9, because I think District 9 is a very good movie and a very original story. I think that has a chance. I would not rule out District 9.
Oh, I would. No one has a chance of taking it away from Inglourious Basterds.
I don't want to see anyone take it from Tarantino.
Well, the only one I think could is maybe Up in the Air. This could be the one category where give it to that.
But I think at least in the Oscars it will be different because it will be original screenplay. And Inglourious Basterds will face two or possibly three tough choices.
Sorry. Best original song, motion picture, Avatar. I See You, Brothers. Bono did a song for Brothers. It's hard to find a movie that there's a project that Bono doesn't do a song for nowadays. Crazy Heart, The Weary Kind.
I think Crazy Heart's the winner here.
Okay, good. Way to jump the gun. Everybody's Fine. Paul McCartney did a song for Everybody's Fine. And they're a good fit because they're both very forgettable. Nine? Cinema Italiano, which
they
is the most
something to nine. That's where they're going to give it.
Yeah, which is the most reviled song of the movie among
people
that don't
even
like the
movie.
Yeah, interestingly enough, yeah.
It's the Kate Hudson one, right? Cinema Italiano.
Mm-hmm. Actually, though, that number though in the original show is one of the best numbers. So I think Kate Hudson is.
It was written specifically for the movie.
That's what he means. It was the best number.
No, wait. Because no, they actually know that because people have said this song is actually. Okay, well, they really blew this one.
Be Italian is the Fergie song from the play.
I actually like that better, too.
Yeah, me too. I think it's going to Crazy Heart, T-Bone Burnett. Much
and
my
I think
personal
it's the Oscar winner, too.
Mm-hmm.
Do you give a shit, Chris?
couldn't care less. Couldn't give a fuck.
I'm sorry. I feel like I've put Chris in a bad mood. Like I'm attacking him.
No, buddy.
You
absolutely have not put me in a bad mood. No. I mean, I feel sorry for you, but
you're my best friend in the world. I love you.
I didn't realize before today that you were mentally retarded. You know.
Does this make you want to like go out and like watch Rain Man again, Chris, with him? Or?
Oh, God.
Jamie is Rain Man.
Or, like, watch the Crank Anchors, the special ed-focused episode? Okay.
Best original score. Best original score. Avatar, James Horner. Informant, Marvin Hamlisch. A Single Man, that guy with the Polish name. Up, Michael Giacchino. Where the Wild Things Are, Carter Burwell.
They're
that's
all
nice.
Great choices. All great choices.
Except for Avatar.
Oh, I thought the music
sorry,
was
Chris.
For Avatar.
I just thought it was very derivative.
I mean, it's...
It does have the same theme.
Okay,
story,
all right, if I had to pick, Giacchino is definitely, you know, Up is great, but I love the soundtrack to Where the Wild Things Are. I love Karen.
I do, too.
I mean, it's a beautiful soundtrack. But I wouldn't rule. I think they might give it to Marvin Hamlisch. You're talking about name, star power here, and this is a big deal, the score. They're going to give it to him.
That really
Marvin
pulls
Hamlisch.
Tom, tell me about it. That guy gets blown on a nightly basis.
Yeah.
Are you Marvin Hamlisch?
Hey, I got fitted for a suit next to him, okay? You know, what can I say?
Oh.
He's actually his return. He was a very popular composer, and this marks his return to movies. It's a big deal.
I mean, I'm not making this up. I mean, you all think I'm on acid or something, but I'm not.
I think it could be Up though.
Yeah, I do too. It's a pleasure and honor that.
Best animated film: Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs, Coraline, Fantastic Mr. Fox, The Princess and the Frog, and Up. probably up, right? I mean, it's another Pixar year, even though Fantastic Mr. Fox belongs.
I was going to say
somewhere.
It has stiff competition this year.
Yeah, which is surprising.
I would say so, too.
Fantastic Mr. Fox and Up. I'm not Up, but I'm Coraline. Coraline has got a lot of buzz around it, and it's a very good film, but...
So is The Princess and the Frog. People are really digging this
hand-drawn
thing again. Like,
yeah, that's another one. You're absolutely right, Chris.
I think this is the first year in a long time that the Pixar movie is not the runaway. In fact, I'd say it was a four-way tie between, with the exception of Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs. I really feel like any of these movies has a really great chance.
Yeah, you're right.
Kind of surprising, because Up, I thought we would take it clearly, but now it's a little bit more in doubt.
I think you got the Fantastic Mr. Fox, but I think Chris is absolutely right. Now, even after that, the Princess and the Frog definitely is a, because people are like championing the hand drawn animation. He's absolutely right.
Okay, well, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No. Please go ahead.
The television stuff. I'm sorry, I interrupted you. Clearly, I'm retarded. Best television drama.
Very good.
The nominees.
We're going to the television nominees now?
No, we're going to do this real quick. Big Love, Dexter, House, Mad Men, True Blood. I don't know what they choose for this kind of thing. What's your favorite show out of all of them that you've seen?
I don't watch any of them.
Dexter and True Blood, I mean.
Dexter and True Blood is the most popular. Well, I mean, Mad Men is exceptionally popular.
Mad Men might get it, though, I think, actually. So.
Yeah, Mad Men is popular among adults.
Yeah.
Not retarded people. Vampires.
Chris cracks me up.
Retarded
Best television series, musical or comedy, Entourage, Glee, The Office, Modern Family, 30 Rock.
I think it's
the
Glee.
Glee. Yeah, probably.
The Runaway. Although Modern Family is one of the funniest shows on television in quite some time. So actually, I'm gonna say it's between those two, because the Globes on the television front, it's funny. On the television front, the Globes are typically sort of out in front of everyone else in terms of rewarding things before they become truly popular.
You're right.
Strange. They're not like that with the movies, but they always are with the TV shows like 30 Rock, Arrested Development, The British Office. They're always on the forefront as far as rewarding these things. So it's going to be one of those two. Don't know which.
Let's not go through all the rest of the television. That's essentially it. Let's take a phone call real quick, and then we'll close up with our mystery movie song of the show.
I hope this is another winning phone call.
No, I think this is Roland.
That's the Alice call.
Is this Roland?
Yeah. Hey, Jamie.
Hey, what's up, man?
I was just listening to you guys run through that stuff.
You had nothing better to do tonight.
Yeah.
Okay, you're rolling. I think I gotta send you a check. If I had more money, I would send you a check.
Yeah.
So, what are your thoughts about anything?
Well, I saw Avatar tonight.
Avatar. Oh, great. The guy that hates everything is just Avatar. All right, give it to me.
It was all right. No, I mean,
coming from someone who has the temperament of Donnie Logan, that's pretty fucking high praise.
I didn't like the 3D part. I mean, I saw it with the 3D glasses on.
I didn't like the 3D part. That should be it. That's classic.
And I kept thinking, I think I want to go and see this again in 2D, you know?
I'd be interested in seeing it in 2D and see how it plays in 2D.
Yeah.
I don't think it would play very well.
Jamie,
well, isn't that a fault of shouldn't it play just as well?
No. You're absolutely missing the point if you say that. The whole point of this movie is to see it in 3D. It's the filmmaking of the 3D. That's the star of the movie. Not the goddamn blue people, not the fucking story. Like, it's what he does with light and color and shadow and depth of field in 3D. That's the experience. It has nothing to do with any of this other stuff.
I don't think that's a good enough reason to make a movie.
But
if you want your movie to survive, I mean, you should be able to watch it at home without a 3D TV.
Well, there's lots of movies that are released on DVD, and they come with the 3D glasses, you know. I mean, so it's not going to be the kind of experience that it is in the theater. But we say this about movies all the time. It's never going to be as good as it was. You need to see it in the theater because it's never going to be that good again. I mean, we say that about epic movies all the time. You could say that about Titanic. You could say that about every one of his movies, you know. I mean, we always make that. And I don't think that that's the only reason to see the movie. But I think that every movie that's great has something that makes it special. That's what makes this movie special. And listen to me, I don't disagree with you about these story points. Like, I don't disagree with you that the story is not, you know, amazing. Like, I wasn't blown away by the story. I just didn't give a shit. Like, that was not the point, you know? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I understand. This retard understands.
Jamie,
Roland,
I understand.
Roland, so you saw Avatar. You weren't blown away by the 3D?
Well, it's just not my kind of thing, you know. I kind of went to see it under duress because I hated Titanic. But it's an achievement. It's an amazing achievement. But
oh, God.
I wish I had seen Broken Embraces in 3D, but okay.
I just can't see how he's going to get Oscar. You know, if he gets Oscar nominations and everything for it, then I'm going to kind of think it's a bit of a joke, you know.
Well, I mean, I'm not a strong proponent of the Oscars, but I do think it's a shoo-in because of the last film, even though it was 12 years ago. The Academy obviously loves him, or you know, maybe these members aren't alive anymore from the last time. But
I think the only thing against it at the Oscars is what we mentioned earlier, is that it skews older. And I don't know that older people, the old coggers in the Academy, care very much about the latest computer technology.
Might, though, Jamie, because those old coggers might have come of age or been in their, like, you know, 20s and 30s for Star Wars and Raiders of the Lost Ark, so they might like and nominate the film. I'm just saying that they might.
Okay.
Yeah,
you
hear a pin drop during that one.
Go ahead, Roland. I'm sorry.
What do you guys think of the Stephen Lang's performance?
I think he did what was required by the script. I think he's a really good presence. I think that character was the only time really with the dialogue that I was aware of Cameron's clunkiness of dialogue.
Yeah,
I was aware.
Everyone's been saying he steals the movie and everything. I think he's a really good actor, but I just kind of felt that
he is. Did you hear his interview on our show?
No. When was that?
It was Wednesday night. We interviewed him, and he put a lot of thought into that character. There was a lot of subtle stuff going on that he talked about.
It reminded me, though, a lot of, I mean, and I like the performance, but it did remind me a lot of Michael Biehn's character in The Abyss. That was the first thing I kept thinking, you know, that I thought
he
of.
Was the only good thing in Public Enemies, right?
He was in Public Enemies, that's right.
Yeah.
He was the only good thing in it.
I thought you said Enemas.
Well, I did have to, it did do something like that to me, yes, but
Public Enemas. Public Enemas, that's great. And we talked a lot about the differences between the similarities between Michael Mann and James Cameron, because he just worked with them back to back, and they're taskmasters. They're meticulous. They operate their own camera a lot. You know, they're in your face. They're aggressive.
I thought we'd be talking about Public Enemies now. I really thought that's my big disappointment this year. I really thought all of us would be talking about like everyone's nomination. You know, and it just. I'm watching that film, and I tell you, I'm waiting for it to come alive, and it, only in a little bit of spurts does it really come alive.
Yeah, you were disappointed by Public Enemies too, right, Chris?
It's hard not to. I don't know anyone who wasn't disappointed by it.
Yeah.
I mean, it was so dull and forgettable. And it's interesting. I mean, I wonder what it looks like on Blu-ray. It's strange. Seeing a movie on Blu-ray on a great, you know, high-definition television, it actually looks better than it does seeing it on the screen. Like, we're now in an age where you have the potential to watch a movie and have it look better at your house.
Yeah.
Truly better. Truly much, much better, actually, and sound better than it does at the movie theater. So I wonder how how that movie looks at home, but the story and the pacing of the movie and the performances were so fucking wooden and boring that it would not matter at all. I could not bring myself to watch that again.
No, it's a hard film to, I would imagine, to watch again. I mean, I like Marion Cotillard's performance. There are moments, but I mean, I'm talking about maybe 10 minutes of, how long was it, 2.5 hours? I'm talking about 10 minutes altogether that was worthwhile the whole film. And I'm not talking about altogether. I'm just talking about various points of the movie. But I never felt like there's never any divine spark where that film comes alive.
Mm-hmm.
And I really, that's the big disappointment of the year for me.
Yeah, me too.
I was going to ask,
Garvin,
if there's one movie that is, what are the movies that that were really great this year that no one's really talking about?
District 9.
District 9.
I'm with Roland there. I mean, it's a really great. It comes out of left field. Regardless, you see the trailer, you hear Peter Jackson's involvement, but you're watching it, and it's not at all what I thought from the trailer. There's so much more going on there.
Yeah.
It's worth all the praise that it's getting. I hope it gets more recognition.
District 9 was a much better movie than Avatar.
No.
There is that argument going around, Roland. You're not alone there. There is a movement that's building out there.
Oh, yeah. If you compare the two, one made for, what, $30 million, the other one made for, what, $500 million, and, you know, you just compare
it. Where can I get this $500 million?
Whatever it is.
I just, Roland, you're digging a coffin, man.
no, but he is bringing up, this is a movement building. I do like District 9. I don't know if I would... But he is bringing up there's a lot of things going on in District 9.
Well, there's always going to be people that begrudge a movie because of its budget.
Well, I don't think Roland's not that...
No, I'm not saying that Roland's one of them. I'm saying that what have we heard about Avatar from the very beginning? The money, the amount of money it costs. It was the same thing with Titanic. It's irrelevant if the movie works. It doesn't matter how much it costs.
Well, I think the movie works. The movie works, but it's because you hear so much in advance about the technology and the budget, then you can't help but go in with some kind of pre-expectation.
Mm-hmm.
Well, any problem I have with Avatar has nothing to do with where the money went, because the money's all on screen. I mean, it's not like a movie you look at and said, where the hell did all that money go?
I mean, I like the message of the film. I mean, I think the film has a lot of things going for it.
As far as other movies that nobody's talking about, I honestly can't think of any. Did you have something in mind, Chris?
I think of a lot, actually.
Yeah, the ones that come to mind, I don't feel like District 9 is underrepresented because it is got a couple Golden Globe nominations and it's on a lot of top 10 lists. I feel like Where the Wild Things Are has been incredibly underrepresented in top 10. Drag Me to Hell, the last Harry Potter movie, which was really, really fantastic.
I'd like to
those movies are getting really good, and I thought it was underrepresented. No, I don't expect any of those movies to get Oscar nominations or anything like that.
Well,
but
there are some. I think Adventureland, Bright Star, Coco Before Chanel. They contain great performances or good stories, but they're not getting it. I'm not saying I expect Adventureland because it was a horribly marketed film, but it's a great film, but I don't expect that to get anything, but it's a film we're not talking about. But also Bright Star, I would nominate Abbey Cornish, and I would nominate
Abbey
Pascal for Coco Before Chanel, but I don't see that happening.
Yeah. Away We Go to the same.
You're right.
Away
about
We Go is, I think, Sam Mendes' best film, personally. But
yeah,
you're right
and
about Drag Me to Hell.
I thought Maya Rudolph would have a chance at an acting nomination.
I thought so too.
And frankly, I feel like she still does. Because a lot of these people in these categories, I don't feel like are anywhere near as good as her performance was. But
mm-hmm.
It was her performance is a revelation. I mean,
you
and
see
as far
the.
As Drag Me, as far as Drag Me to Hell goes, like I certainly did not expect. I didn't expect Golden Globe nominations. I certainly don't expect any Oscar nominations for that movie.
But you expected it to do better.
To do better, and I would expect it to be on more top 10 lists. You know, because it was such a good time, and it was such a real fun old horror house kind of movie.
We talked to Adam Green, Chris, just yesterday, and he's directing horror movies and things. He's got something up at Sundance. And he said, you know, these damn fanboys, you know, they complain a bitch about the remakes, and yet they go see them opening weekend. Meanwhile, a great horror movie like A Drag Me to Hell comes out, and none of them support it.
Right.
Right. Right. Yeah.
So you're not alone in that thinking. I mean, yeah. Roland, have you seen anything else before we log off?
He saw Harry Brown. I'm still jealous about that.
I can't think of anything that you guys haven't seen, really. Adventureland, I still haven't caught yet. Away We Go, I didn't like that, Jerry.
I know, but I of all of Sam Mendes' films, I'd have to say Where He's Going, what he's trying to do, I thought he did it best there.
He's going away from the title.
Yeah, I'm sure of that. But, you know, look, I think it was Lisa Schwartzman put it on her worst list of the year. From
but
that
they also, Gleiberman also put it on his best list for Drag Me to Hell.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I thought An Education was good. I thought the ending was bad, though. I haven't seen Precious yet.
Oh, I can't wait to hear what you think of Precious. I want you to call in first thing when you see that. I'm going to actually advertise the show.
Oh, really?
For Precious. I can't wait.
I've seen the trailers and I was laughing. I don't know. I'm not sure about that. I mean,
did you see the trailer for Iron Man 2 that came out this week?
Oh, guys, didn't you guys like Iron Man? Because I really didn't like it.
How could you not like Iron Man?
That surprised me. Roland, you need to come on as a guest, not as a caller. We need to get all this out in the open because I just love
that.
It. Wonderful.
Oh, man, Iron Man, I just thought it was dreadful. And then at the end, they just rip off. And then at the end, they just kind of go into this Transformers thing at the end. Oh, I know what we can do. We can make it Transformers now, you know. And
screw that movie that tried to give me a good time.
You know
that
what?
Cheap shit.
People have seen Sherlock Holmes, and they're saying it's not too bad.
Well, I didn't think it looks pretty good. I mean, I'd like to see it. I mean, which one? Sorry, I didn't catch that. Which Sherlock Holmes?
Sherlock Holmes.
Oh, Sherlock Holmes. Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's a mystery still.
No, it's not a mystery. It's a musical or comedy.
Yeah.
Have any of you guys seen 9 yet or not?
No, I think 9 is the disaster of the end of
nine.
The year.
9 is my answer to that question. Sorry, throwing down a little German for you guys.
You're so funny.
Yeah.
All right, Roland, thank you, buddy. I'm sorry you're on hold for so long.
Roland, okay, you got to call in with your review of Precious, though. You really do.
I'll call in next week.
I can't wait to hear this.
Well, next week we'll be back with CCH Pounder. You know who CCH Pounder is?
Mm-hmm.
She's a great, really intense actress. She plays the mother of Zoe Saldana in Avatar, and she's been in recurring roles in The Shield and lots of strong characters in movies.
Ellen Bernstein on earlier tonight?
Yes, she was.
Oh, wow.
And then we have the lead creature designer from Avatar that's coming on. And then we have our Sundance show coming up, and we've been told we'll have Jeff Bridges in the new year.
Yeah.
So we've got we got turned down by Matthew Broderick. But we got Jeff Bridges, so.
Getting turned down by Matthew Broderick is a good thing.
Apparently, judging from the gossip trades, Matthew Broderick should turn down more people. by the way, we won't talk about Tiger Woods. This is a movie show. Okay, our mystery movie song last week was Sister Christian from Boogie Nights. And I think, hang on. I've got to refresh this. Hang on. This is a really good movie song this week. I think it's one that Chris will really like, too, as well as Jerry. Give me one moment. Fill some time. I got to refresh my switchboard.
I actually have to say Roland brought up a good point about An Education. There is something about the ending that's very unsatisfying.
Yeah, they kind of copped out at the end where they made him to be the regular cliché kind of teacher preying upon young schoolgirls.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. It really, because her performance is so good, and then that comes about, and you're like, wow, that's really, you're absolutely right. Cliched is the right.
And then they're questioning the whole notion of going to university and studying hard at school, and then right at the end, they copped out of that as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Hey, I meant to ask you guys, how do you want to do this? Because, Uwe Boll just sent me an email.
Jamie, I need you to help me now.
Now, we all three of us kind of want to do different things, Chris. Since we've done the top 20 of 20, and I know you want to do the top 10 of the decade, Jerry wants to do the top 10 of the year, and I'd like to do like the top 10 trends of the decade in movies. How about we all three do a different list? each of our lists on an upcoming show.
That'd be good. I mean, I was just going to do an alternative movies I didn't pick for that. If that's our view for the decade.
Well, yeah. Well, okay. Well, then I'm the only odd man out.
No. I'll do. But if you want me to do the deck of the year, I'll do the year. I mean, whatever you want me to do, I'll do.
So, Jerry, you do the top 10 of the year. Chris, you do your top 10 of the decade since you weren't part of that show before. And I'll do the top 10 movie trends of the decade. Does that sound good?
That sounds fair enough.
Yeah, I could be a part of that. That would be fun.
All right. We'll work out a time. Thank you guys very much. Here's our mystery movie song of the week from a great film. And I predict it might be a film on either – I know it was on Jerry's list. It probably will be on Chris's list for Best of the Decade, maybe. Here it goes. Thank you, guys. I love you all.
See you, Jerry.
All right. Good night, everyone.
See you,
Jerry. Bye.
Now I know Spanish Harlem are not just pretty words to say. Thought I knew, but now I know that rose trees never grow in New York City. Until you've seen this trash can dream come true, you stand at the edge while people run you through. I thank the Lord there's people out there like you. I thank the Lord there's people out there like you. While Mona Lisa's and Mad Hatter's sons of bankers, sons of lawyers turn around and say good morning to the night. For unless they see the sky, but they can't, and that is why. They know not if it's dark outside or light. It's Broadway's got, it's got a lot of songs to sing. If I knew the tunes, I might. Go my way alone, grow my own seed, shall be sown in New York City. Subway's no way for a good man to go down. Rich man can ride, and the hobo, he can drown. I have found. guys, but they can't.